Badlands. Explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
We want to feel younger
and get that spark of libido back into your life. It's no secret that systems of our world have been set up to lower our hormone levels, reduce our divine motivation, and keep us feeling sluggish. You don't need toxic energy drinks or pharmaceuticals to get a grip on your life and rekindle the spark of passion. Pine pollen is nature's highest source of brassinosteroids and helps to boost libido, drive, blood flow, and energy by regulating hormone levels and giving you your edge back. It's nature's best-kept secret, with over 200 nutrients supporting vitality, motivation, and vigor. Now, through the end of the month, visit badlandsmedia.tv/ascent and use promo code BADLANDS to unlock the ancient secret and save 10% on all products ordered. That's badlandsmedia.tv/ascent, promo code BADLANDS.
You been taking that stuff?
Oh, yeah, I've been taking it. It's been great.
Your libido's good?
my libido is great. Welcome to Vigilant News Interviews, everybody. We have a special guest for you here today, Courtney Turner of the Courtney Turner Podcast. Courtney, welcome. How's it going?
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Yeah. I've been really excited to have you back on the show. We're going to cover a subject that I've been very passionate about for a while, and Courtney is an expert in, so it's going to be a real treat. Just let me know, by the way, audience, if you're seeing if the audio is good, hit one. If it's not so great, hit a two. And if you have any questions for Courtney, I'll be doing what I usually do, which is posting at you got to you guys in the chat. If you have any questions, go ahead and pop those questions in the chat in all caps for me so we can get those questions answered. With that, Courtney, do me a favor, tell me a little bit about how you got into the subject of Tavistock.
So this was kind of a big part of my awakening journey. I would make the joke that, you know, I was very late to find the train station, and then I found the high-speed rail, and I've been scrambling to try and catch up since. But it was in 2020, a friend of mine sent me this video from Dr. John Coleman. He did a speech on the Committee of 300, and he said to me, have you ever heard of him? Have you ever seen this? And I said, no. And he said, okay, watch this and then call me back after you've watched it. This was, of course, midnight, because that's always the time when people have these pressing things that they have to send me and get my feedback on. So I called him back after I watched the video, and we were on the phone until about 5 a.m. And I, from there, started to consume as much as I possibly could of his material. I was so fascinated. And I found his book on Tavistock, which at the time was retailing on Amazon for almost $5,000.
Of course.
Wow. So I did not purchase the book. Since then, Amazon is now selling it. It's probably a revised edition, but it's now selling for almost $30, which is much more affordable.
Yeah, much more reasonable price.
But at the time, I downloaded it, the PDF, and I read it 3 times in a week. That's how intrigued I was. I was just riveted. And I felt like it just really explained so much to me that, you know, it kind of put a lot of pieces together for me. A lot of my, intellectual pursuits, you know, my early academic interests had been in fields of psychology and philosophy. And then I was an actress. So Tavistock kind of showed how much of the religious social engineering had occurred and the origins, really the convergence of the field of philosophy and psychology, I think in many ways were born out of Tavistock. Of course, they had a huge impact on infiltration of the culture.
Right.
So that was really interesting to me. And I don't know. That was kind of my first introduction.
That's how I knew we were going to be good friends, because you have the same level of geekiness and passion for these subjects that I do. So yeah, that's one of the things I did not know when I heard about the subject of the Tavistock Institute was, first of all, how much it kind of gave birth to the modern world as we know it, especially with all of its various intelligence infiltration, the media, manipulation of our education system, even the medical system, but also that this kind of the same players and actors that were involved in a lot of the late 1800s, early 1900s stuff. We're doing this. So tell us a little bit about, like, what is the Tavistock Institute for people who don't know what that is?
So most people are familiar, and you know, I'm really glad this kind of brought awareness to people. But in 2020, there was a lot of controversy over the transgender clinic. And I think that was really most people's first introduction to Tavistock. And they have since, in 2022, they were actually shut down because there were several lawsuits surrounding the children with puberty blockers. And so people have this association of Tavistock as being the Tavistock gender clinic. And that is certainly a part of Tavistock, they have many tentacles, as we will dive into. Yeah. But the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations is, you know, more of their public outfit, but it really began as a propaganda bureau. It was literally a propaganda bureau.
Did it grow out of, what was it called, like the Wellington?
Yes. So they called it the Lie Factory. that was kind of the colloquial name for it. But it was literally a propaganda bureau. And this was in the early 1900s. We can back up after this, but I tend to start out with, you know, the late 1800s to give people kind of the context and backstory. But just so people know, it's always under the guise of defense, right? I always make the joke that if they put a D in front of it, it means they get a black ops, carte blanche budget. They can do whatever they want covertly. Nobody questions it because nobody even knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And then oftentimes those research projects get weaponized against the very people that they were supposedly defending and protecting.
Oh, yeah.
And that's exactly what happened in this case, is that there was a German propaganda bureau. And so they decided that they needed to have a British propaganda bureau. Mm. They, you know, this sound familiar? Like, they have super soldiers. Well, we need to create super soldiers, right? They have bioweapons. We need a bioweapons, department. So this is their typical MO. And that is exactly what they did. The Germans had a propaganda bureau. So they created a British propaganda bureau. And this was the purpose was to garner acquiescence and create propaganda to get the British people and the American populace to engage in World War One. It was a very tall order, because Woodrow Wilson had ran on the campaign that he would not do that.
And they were putting out propaganda of like German soldiers with babies on bayonets and all this kind of stuff. That was them, right?
That was them. So there was something called the Creel Commission, and they had appointed Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, of course, he famously wrote the book Propaganda in 1928. He was also the double nephew of Sigmund Freud. He's known as the father of PR. I would say that title rightfully goes to Willy Munzenberg, but he's not very much talked about. But he was the double nephew of Sigmund Freud. And then his nephew is the founder of today's modern propaganda machine, also known as Netflix. His name is Mark Randolph Bernays. He actually went to Hamilton College, which is my alumni alma mater.
Wow.
So I remembered that. But he and Walter Lippmann were tasked with overseeing Woodrow Wilson to create this propaganda in America. And Walter Lippmann was a journalist, and they then developed something called the Creel Commission. And that was George Creel who created these ads. Later in World War II, they did the Meet the Promise ads. Creel did he got into filmmaking. He did a bunch of shorts, like 4-minute shorts, really targeting the American population. In 1916, they weaponized the term isolationist. So you'll probably remember this got resurrected during Roosevelt. And it also then made another reappearance when Ron Paul was running, and he was garnering a lot of popularity on the political right. And then, you know, that was the way they were able to shut him down.
Like,
this crazy isolationist. We can't have his foreign policy.
And so, now that's Ben Shapiro uses the term to describe anybody who isn't down with funding Israel.
Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's a whole other topic, but it's related just tangentially, because Tavistock was really created out of the Fabian Socialist movement. And the Fabian Socialists were very instrumental in creating that dialectic. And a great book on this is Ion Ratu. He's got a book called The Milner Fabian Conspiracy. And the first half of the book, he talks about, you know, the World Zionist Federation, how the Fabians were very instrumental in creating the Zionist movement. But then in the second half of the book, he says those very same people created and funded the Islamification of the West.
Wow.
And so they're creating this dialectical pole.
Yeah.
So as usual, it's the same people funding both ends and stirring the controversy on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. You have both the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic State and the Israel lobby basically at the highest echelons of power in the West.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, You know, one thing that we talk about quite often in the, on the show, and for, especially for the people listening here, is that, you know, people are asleep. You often, people feel like, you know, I'm waking up, I'm coming out of a slumber. So if you think about what that means relationally, well, for people who are asleep, what happens when you're asleep? You're very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Or when you're in a hypnotic trance, what's happening? Basically, you look like you're asleep. So it's almost like, to think about the, put this in perspective, you know, these people had decided that they were going to transition the world into a kind of covert elite run world, where the world was going to still be run by the elites, except the people were going to think that they had actually the power, and that we were going to live from republic or democrat organized societies. And that can only work if people are awake. You can't drive your car if you're asleep. You can't do your accounting if you're asleep. You know, so what does that mean translationally? And what it means is that we are living in a world where, since most of the population is asleep, as almost everybody listening to us right now will agree, then there's a system for managing and controlling the thoughts, opinions, values, and ultimately the actions of the people who are asleep. And it's these guys we're talking about who started to pull the whole thing off way back when. So
yeah, Justin always uses the phrase, these guys are masters in psychology, and they've totally weaponized it. And that is the best way to describe what the Tavistock Institute is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's, I guess let's just start, like, where would you think would be a good place to start the story, the saga of the town?
I really start with the Leipzig connection. So this is a tiny little book. It was written by Klaus and Leonie, but I think something happens when you buy a later iteration of a book and things change, because they only have Leonie's name on it. But I've done the research, and it is Klaus and Leonie who put together this book. And this is the book that both Charlotte Iserbeet and Anthony Sutton used to fuel their research on the history of education and how, like, the Order of Skull and Bones took over. Anthony Sutton has, I don't have it with me, but he has a whole chapter in his book that's dedicated to how the Order of Skull and Bones took over education system and how they exported essentially the Prussian model of education to the United States. Charlotte Iserbeet was a whistleblower under the Reagan administration, and she was really blowing the whistle on a project called BEST, which was tied to the tech ed that's being used in the SEL programs now. She blew the whistle. She was talking about she called it Communist Core. She didn't even call it Common Core. But her father and her grandfather were both members of Skull and Bones. So she had access to these little, essentially little black books. And she shared them with Anthony Sutton, and he used it for his research.
Wow. Okay.
So I would really start there. And the reason I start there is because the father of psychology, who's known as the father of psychology, would be Wilhelm Wundt. And he was really the father of experimental psychology. And it's interesting, kind of ironic, because he's credited. So psychology is typically thought of as a doctoring the soul, right? That's the translation of psychology. However, he was the one to claim, his contribution was that humans do not have spirit. He actually thought that we were soulless. He really subscribed to kind of the Descartesian model of mind body, and he was trying to quantify everything. So he was attributed as being really the first experimental psychologist, and he had the first lab, the first psychology lab, and he had several students under him. I think he had hundreds of PhDs under him. They were very, very famous names. They were people like Granville Stanley Hall. And he was really the father of child psychology. And he was also the mentor to John Dewey. John Dewey was also very instrumental in exporting this Prussian model of education to the United States. Who else was there? Some of the other people would be like William James, who's known as the father of American psychology. There was Pavlov, and Pavlov was very instrumental in not just education, but psychology. And this whole, that led to later the Skinnerian method, where things, it's really, instead of just, and this is really where Tavistock is so instrumental and why it's so important for people to understand, because they don't just research, but then they do these studies on how do we modify. It's like, you know, a good way to think of it is like they, you know, wind you up because they know what makes you tick,
right?
You know, and then they can calculate the breaking points, and then they know how to instill essentially trauma-based mind control. That's really what it all leads to. But I started with Wilhelm Wundt, and
real quick,
that was
Courtney,
in the late 1800s.
Yeah, we got people asking what the name of the book is, and I'll pop it into the chat.
This is Basics in Education: The Leipzig Connection. It's a tiny book. So I think this one's not even 100 pages. I think it may have originally been 155, but
yeah. And if you're getting lost with all the names that are flying around, it happens sometimes. No, don't worry about it. You do your thing, because it's what's so critical to understand is just how influential these guys were. So if you've ever heard of the Dewey Decimal System, that
different
is
Dewey.
Due for Dewey?
It's a different Dewey.
Oh, different Dewey. Okay, okay.
It is a different Dewey.
Apologies.
But Dewey is very, very instrumental in exporting this Prussian model. So there was a battle of Jena in the Napoleonic Wars. This was in 1807. They lost the Battle of Jena. And they decided that they lost because the soldiers rebelled, and that they rebelled because they were critical thinkers. And so they decided that they needed to read, really the translation would be mindless, obedient soldiers.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they created a three-tier model of education that was tailored towards breeding compliance. And this is what they ended up exporting to the United States. It was very, they were really like determined to, you know, get the United States to be dumbed down, to be, to eradicate essentially the critical thinking.
This
skills.
Is the Prussian model, because a lot of our Badlands audience, I think it was a Ghost of Base Patrick Henry. He did the whole Prussia Gate series. It wasn't
somebody
him.
Did that, yeah.
But I know a lot of our audience is familiar, but they might not be familiar with that aspect of it.
So. Yeah. So they actually had a 3-tier model, and I don't remember like what the classes were called. I mean, it's kind of like, I'm assuming that it was somewhat related to like the Platonic stratification, but essentially there, the top would have been the equivalent. They may have even called it aristocratic education. But it was this idea, but even they were going to be compliant. And you have these two schools of, it's based on Hegel. So the most important thing for people to understand, and Dewey was a Hegelian, Wundt was a Hegelian. He was very, very strongly and heavily influenced by Hegel. He was influenced by a lot of mystical, you know, romantic philosophers. He was a philosopher primarily, and then, you know, established he was the first to call himself a psychologist. Yeah, Wilhelm Wundt.
So before we get a little bit further, I just wanted to ask you to tell the audience about Hegel, because Hegel's a huge figure in all this, but he wasn't alive at the time. He had been dead for some period of time, wasn't he?
Yep.
So why was he so influential in these circles, and why is, you know, why would the world be shaped by Hegel's thoughts and opinions today?
Well, Marx was very influenced by Hegel, and Marx was certainly very, you know, very much promoted. And I mean, this is speculation on my behalf, but I honestly think it has to do with secret society ties.
It definitely does.
Yeah, I really do think so, because Hegel, as far as I can see, did not have any direct, you know, he wasn't in any specific secret society, but he was very influenced by Johann Gottlieb Fichte. And he was a member of the Illuminati.
The League of the Just and all those. Is the
So Goethe was also a member of the Illuminati. And he was very influenced by Goethe. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, the German name. But yeah, so Marx. So there was the Illuminati, which, of course, you know, was the official Bavarian Illuminati. It got shut down. And then the reason we know about it is actually because when it was shut down, there was somebody who was killed, and he was carrying.
Yeah, it was. The histories, there's two different names. There was like, he was a Catholic, a false Catholic priest who was delivering messages, and he had all of their stuff sewn into his garment. and they found all of the names, all of the secret names.
Well, he was killed. And then when he was killed, the police, the Bavarian police found all of his belongings that were attached to him.
Wow.
Yeah.
And wasn't he struck by lightning or something like that?
Well, that's one of the myths that he was struck by lightning.
That he was struck by lightning. That's how he died.
Oh. Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, I wasn't there at the time. Sorry. Yeah.
That's one of the versions of the story. Because I was looking this up for the dive I did on it. And that's just one of the versions of the story. But they all kind of say, and there's different people they say it was who got struck. Mm-hmm. But it happened in this town. And like you were saying, that the local law found all of these things, like how to make a poison, how to kill somebody without knowing that they died by murder, like making it look like natural causes.
Yep.
Ciphers, code names for everybody in the organization.
So so the Hegelian dialectic.
So I just to address what you were saying, because it is relevant. So the Illuminati got shut down, and then they had several offshoots. League of Outlaws was one of them. There was the League of the Outlaws, then an offshoot from there became the League of the Just.
The Bundergrecken, they call it. Yeah.
And the League of the Just was helmed by Marx and Engels.
Right. Okay.
And then, of course, that merged with the Communist League. And they were commissioning Engels to write a manifesto for the Communist League. Mm. He took notes and basically made a hybrid of Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati Manifesto.
Oh, I see.
And Clinton Roosevelt, a book that was called The Science of Government Founded on Natural Law, and basically plagiarism. And it was a compilation of those two that made the Communist League Manifesto, which later became the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx. But they didn't even put Karl Marx's name on initially. They did it like a publicity campaign for him. Mm-hmm. They had him write several, articles, journals around the topic. And then they later put his name on it. But I do think it's relevant because so many of these people were, they influenced Hegel. Mm. And Hegel had a huge influence on Marx, right? He would say, like, you have to stand Hegel on his head. Right. And really, so Hegel, the most important thing for people to understand about Hegel is that for Hegel, the state is God.
Yeah.
So everything is about, I'm certainly not the only one. People talk about the spiral, and I think it's a really great way to visually look at, or think about Hegel's dialectic. So I was talking about Joanna Gottlieb Fichte before, right? Mm-hmm. And Hegel was influenced by him. So people often think of thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually Fichte's interpretation of Kant's dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kant was an idealist, but he wasn't a mystic. Right. I try to make that distinction for people. I think it's important. I really do.
Sure.
I have issues with the idealists, but it's not the same as I do with the mystics, because mystics tend to invert things.
Mm-hmm.
And Hegel really was he was a hermeticist. And I would say he was an alchemist as well.
Yeah.
So
what is a dialectic for people so they understand what that
is? So he rejected both Kant and Plato's notion of the dialectic. The tip for people just really simply to think of Plato's dialectic is kind of, the allegory of the cave. Mm-hmm. It's the intelligible realm, the unintelligible realm, the dividing line. That would be the very simple explanation for Plato. Then Kant, as interpreted by Fichte, was the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So Hegel actually said that it was the abstract, negative, concrete. And the negative, in my opinion, is the most important element of that, because the German word for that is Aufheben. And it translates to something like sublate, but really it's a very oxymoronic term, because it means to lift up and preserve while simultaneously canceling and tearing down. And this is really where we get the Frankfurt School's concept of Aufheben die Kultur, right? Cancel culture.
Cancel culture. Wow.
Yeah.
And so for Hegel, he sees it as the concrete is kind of this something presented, and then it gets negated, but it's this very oxymoronic, it's really Aufheben.
Right.
And then the synthesis of that is the concretization. So it gets erased while emerging as this new thing. And it as it does that, the dialectic progresses, and it progresses towards an omega point, which for Hegel was the state is God. It's the all-powerful state.
Wow.
And that, I think, is the most important part of The two elements to understand about Hegel in terms of how it gets weaponized and how Tavistock and these social engineers and the education, whatever you want to call them, but the people who manipulated and destroyed our education.
Yeah.
What the two things that are really important is that the state is all powerful. The state is God, and the other is that it's kind of this two sides, the two wings of the same bird.
Right.
Yeah, the right hand of the left hand. And where I was going with that before in terms of the education is that we have the left-wing Hegelians, which are typically thought of as like Marx and Engels would be examples of left-wing. They're scientific socialism, progress through scientific socialism. And then the right wing would be this Prussian militarized concept. And this has been very instrumental in the education system. This is where we get things like, ringing the bell to switch classes, the very structured timing, the
lifelessness of it all, really.
And that all comes out of the quote unquote right wing Hegelians.
So basically, it sounds like you have these two things that seem like they're competing, but they're actually working together. And as these concepts battled each other out in the public square of the people's mind, so to speak, the people are kind of led down a course that they don't even know they're being led down. Is that a good summary?
Yeah. And I would just say that sometimes they're working together, concomitantly, but sometimes it's just that they have the same end goal.
Mm.
And so the end goal is always that, because Hegel actually believed that you couldn't achieve any freedom without subservience to a state. He actually believed that that was like the state is God.
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless of how you get there, that is the end goal. That's the omega point.
Right.
So I just want to stress that for people, because I feel like we live in an age where people are starting to recognize that there's psyops everywhere. There is psychological warfare, but people are not always aware. But what they are aware of is that they might have a similar goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter if somebody is knowingly working in concert, with their opponent, or apparent opponent. If the end goal is the same, then they're going to get there anyway.
Interesting.
And the concept of the state being God, I don't know if Plato intended that to be the case at the Republic, but that was definitely how Adam Weishaupt interpreted it.
Right. And so Adam Weishaupt was a professor at Ingolstadt, and he was a student of the Jesuits, and he modeled the Illuminati after the Jesuit model. That's part of why it had the hierarchical structure. At least this is what he said.
And Freemasonry.
Well, in the Illuminati specifically. He modeled the Illuminati. This is part of why it had the secrecy, because he said that people are more invested if they have a sense of clout, they have a sense of importance. And the secrecy lends itself to that. It, of course, lends itself to levers of power like blackmail.
You know what? I was trying to think of a modern example of these Hegelian dialectic, or I'm not sure what the right word would be for it, but I think of it as like a weaponized version of it, because in a conversation, for example, you might have a position and you want to speak from your position and use your certain points. But if you're open, then you're going to naturally be guided back and forth in the conversation. Mm-hmm. So at a cultural level, it's like we have, the left who are battling for, boys and girls bathrooms and just all the stuff on the opposing end of the pole that's really strong. And then on the right hand side, especially the more corporatized, Conning side.
Yeah,
Daily Wire side. It's like you've got the rage fire kindlers who are just like looking for all these extreme examples, pushing them into people's faces to get them all pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that this is a kind of a leading people down the same course? And is that a modern day example?
Yeah, absolutely. I did a whole video on ARC, Jordan Peterson's ARC, the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship.
Right, I'm not familiar.
And I called it I said it's Jordan Peterson's ARC, the dialectical right arm to build West dreams.
That's good.
Yeah. But I think so. So he claims that it's like a counter to the World Economic Forum, and that it's a bunch of quote unquote conservative, freedom-minded people, liberty-minded, And when you look into it, people can find that on my channel because I did a pretty extensive dive on it. But the when you look into it, the funding entities are actually the same.
Wow.
So it's just this spoiler alert, you know, really is Legatum. Mm-hmm. And Legatum, their client is the World Economic Forum. And wow. They are the primary funding source for Jordan Peterson's Alliance for Responsible
Citizenship. Do you think he knows about this? Like he's in on it or?
So I can't imagine he doesn't know who the funding is.
Right?
Yeah. It's just too, at this point, too, I mean, if I can find it, how does he not know?
Right.
So I can't imagine that I have a lot of questions about Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the history, I went through the filing of the company and it's actually started out as Prosperity UK 2017. And I think that's just very interesting timing. The first that they initially filed in 2016.
Right.
This is right around the time when Jordan Peterson was promulgated to fame.
Right.
When he was talking about against the bill C-16, you know, the Canadian bill. Regarding the pronouns. And that's kind of when he was catapulted to fame. I'm not saying he was like immediately co-opted and, he's like a plant. I don't know. I'm not making those claims. But I do think the timing is pretty interesting that's the convergence of that's when they were building. And, it's a long trajectory, so I won't go into the whole thing. But I do have a lot of questions because I was a huge, huge Jordan Peterson fan.
Sure.
Like, I mean, I was like, total fan girl. Like, I watched everything. And I remember, he went in 2020. He went to rehab. He went to Russia.
Right.
He was in a coma for 6 months.
Yeah.
And he talks about how he was like fractured in two. And then when he came to do the speech for ARC, he was like wearing this basically two colored suit. It was very strange,
really?
Almost
no
like
kidding.
Two-face. And he, he made all sorts of his memory was gone. He talked about how he had learned like how to speak and walk again.
Yeah, I remember
that. Then he comes back and I'm, waiting with bated breath, like right. Jordan Peterson's back. Like I can have company on my runs, I was a huge fan, like I said.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And one of the first podcasts he does, and I don't know if it was the first, but it was the first one I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it was with Douglas Murray.
I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And oh my God. I got through half of it. I actually had to put it down. I couldn't listen anymore.
Okay.
I was so angry. It was, he went on, the two of them went on and on. So now bear in mind, this is a Canadian and a Brit, went on and on talking about how Trump supporters are just like delusional sore losers and they just need to get over it. There was no fraud. And Jordan Peterson actually said that his wife, Tammy, that had said, you always say that the judicial system in the United States is so corrupt. Do you think that there was any of that at play here? And he says, absolutely not. They just need to move on. They need to get over it. And they're weighing in on our election, right? And it was just so, it made me angry the way that they handled it.
Probably landed him a job at the Daily Wire.
They were never Trumpers, like, right? So, but my question is, so my theory, and it is just a theory, but I do suspect that he was MKUltra'd or something to that degree and that he is being used, whether he's aware of it or not. I mean, also remember, he wouldn't let anybody come to his events initially without being vaxxed.
Right.
He was, and now suddenly he's one of the freedom people who's speaking out against the, COVID.
Well, we go in on the Daily Wire regularly lately, especially in light of everything that happened with Candace Owens recently. It was a organization that was basically funded by right-wing billionaires who are kind of the two brothers. They were
the
like
brothers?
Not the Koch brothers, but a pair of who I'd never previously heard of. I have the name here. I can pull it up for you.
Are you talking about who? The Daily Wire?
Yeah, the Daily Wire. Jeremy Boring and Ben Shapiro basically got this cash injection by these millionaires, political activist types, who, maybe they're just regular guys, maybe they're not. Either way, it was created to be this thing, and it certainly fits the Hegelian, like you could see the Daily Wire as the alt version of Fox News, and you could see, like, maybe something like the Young Turks as the alt version of CNN, and it's still... Go ahead.
I would love you to find the names. I wonder if I remember them because I'm pretty sure they got the funding through the group that I was part of, FOA.
Mm.
I actually did a podcast with Jeremy Boring. He was like episode number 17 for me. He was
one of my first ones.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we went into it in the last show.
So he goes through the genesis of Daily Wire. And I you know, I mean, I was part of FOA. My ex had a company with him. So I knew him. So he goes through that history, but I'd be very curious to hear that name.
It's Dan and Ferris Wilkes.
Wilkes.
The Wilkes brothers.
W-I-L-K-S. Wilkes brothers. I don't think I know them. Maybe I do, and I'm just blanking.
Petroleum industry brothers, okay. Super rich.
Yes.
I mean, they certainly fit the bill. Like,
as far as like, in terms of, I can't speak to whether what their intentions are.
Right, right. Yeah,
but what can. I can say is this. So a lot of people think about, you know, the, and Brzezinski and Kissinger wrote about this. I mean, Bertrand Russell talks about this. They talk about how there was going to be an intentional, these are the futurists, they are the geopolitical architects of the world, if you will.
Yeah.
They talk about how they were intentionally going to stoke tensions of the East and the West. You know, these ideologies of capitalism and socialism, throw in some fascism against each other. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, so the in typical Hegelian fashion, technocracy could emerge. And if you look at something like Daily Wire, now this is not a criticism, it's sure. not this is just an observation, but if you look in the, and then he went through this on my podcast, their business model is entirely predicated on Facebook and YouTube.
Really interesting.
Yes, like he talked about how they in millions of dollars before they had a single ounce of content into advertising on them. And so they essentially Facebook and YouTube are their boss. Mm-hmm. So if YouTube gives them a call and says, hey, you gotta, they may argue against me on this, but I'd be very surprised if they weren't feeling at least a little pressure
sure.
that their paycheck is kind of contingent,
the whole
business yeah. revenue I mean, stream. So but I think this is really important and this is relevant to Tavistock because mm-hmm. a lot of people don't touch on this, but I keep trying to bring it up in every opportunity I have just so that I can bring awareness to it for people. But where they're going and the Tavistock are social engineers. So mm-hmm. they condition us to accept things and they condition us, you know, they call it the militaristic term is operational preparation of the environment. Mm. The more colloquial term is known as predictive programming.
Right.
And so that's what they do to us. Now, Tavistock actually coined the term. It was a future shock. That's very much what it is. And so what they're doing right now, and I think they're really trying to prep us for this. A lot of people aren't talking about it, but they're creating something. This is the UN 100 is creating something called the AI World Society. Mm. And so it's the UN Centennial, mm-hmm. which is imagining the anniversary, the 100 anniversary mm-hmm. of the UN. And that would be in 2045.
Right.
They're partnering with the Boston Global Forum. Michael Dukakis, who is known as he was the former governor of Massachusetts.
Okay, I thought so.
Yep. He recently had his, I think, 90th birthday or maybe 93, yeah. something like that. And he wrote this book. It's called Remaking the World, the Age of Global Enlightenment.
Mm.
And they outline this AI world society that they're building that they want to have by 2045.
Wow.
And it is, they actually did a whole symposium on this where the Ukraine is going to be the hub of this AI world society.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And they said, we have to rebuild Ukraine because it's been decimated by the war. We need to send lots of funding and support, but it's also, they can build it and it'd be the hub of this digital world where they would have offshoots of, all these other digital cities around the world. So the 15-minute city, the C40 city, the smart cities, and they're all going to be connected in this grid. And this is where they're going, but they call the age of the remaking the world, the age of global enlightenment.
Hmm.
And this is a very, I think it's a theosophical nod that's the underpinning of the religion. I mean, they talk about creating a one world religion and they talk about how, it looks like, so the one world religion, obviously a one world government. They want an AI government that's going to replace humans.
Mm-hmm.
There will be no human governments. It's going to be an AI government.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on and on about it. It's very dystopian. It's crazy. But the religion, I think, is very important because it looks like, to me, a cyber Satan. But I don't think the AI is actually the religion. I think it is an AI god. But I think that the religion, the underpinnings are very much theosophy, which is kind of predicated on Luciferianism. That's the underpinning for Marxism. It's the underpinning when you look at most of these Tavistock engineers, but that's really the world view.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in that letter that was ostensibly written from Albert Pike to Giuseppe Mazzini. They were talking about how they were going to bring forth that religion like over 100 years ago, well, 200 years ago, really now, through a war that would involve the mutually assured destruction of the Jewish nation and the Islamic state, which we might be witnessing right now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, that, you know, hearing all this from my perspective, it's, if things are pointing in a direction, that it's certainly pointing in an AI controlled direction. I mean, look at how well received the AI revolution has been over the past couple of years now. And to a certain extent, there is, you know, technology is technology, and we are in a competitive race where you kind of have to adapt or die. But at the same time, at certain higher levels, like this, you know, the governance levels, the AI governance is basically handing over sovereignty to something that we don't control, but somebody else programmed.
Well, here's the, the kicker is that we handed over all of our decision-making skills generations ago. Right. And now it's like the people we handed over to down, they want to hand it over to something. Right. So it's like we're a couple layers removed at this point.
I mean, but you know what they're going to do, and this is kind of like, I guess, the omega point of this whole long arc of technocracy that started 100 years ago, or I don't know when we'd want to place the start date, but certainly it became, started to become popularized in the 50s or 60s, I would say, the technocracy.
Technocracy really started in the 30s. Columbia University actually had a whole division devoted to technocracy.
The movie Metropolis was kind of like an allusion to that.
And Elon Musk's grandfather was actually involved in the Technocracy Inc. I think he was the director of Technocracy Inc.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, you know, we have all these media organizations, news organizations, all these things pointing in a certain direction. But is this because this is the way the, you know, the water flows, so to speak, and you have to just go with it or get run over? Or is it because things are being slowly guided from behind the scenes? And kind of my thoughts on this, to take back a few steps with Jordan Peterson as an example, or maybe even some of the people on the Daily Wire, I don't get the impression that they're literally, you know, card-carrying members of any agenda. I think Jordan in particular is somebody who is clearly very brilliant in one sense, but very naive in another sense.
Right.
And these social manipulators, these mind manipulators, they are expert at leveraging these things in very subtle ways that the person who's being leveraged has no idea that it's happening. And I kind of think that's what's going on.
But the analogy that I always use is if somebody were to climb like a scaffold, you know, on a very tall building, you're harnessed, right? Because when you get to the top of the skyscraper, it's pretty high and dangerous.
Right.
So you're wearing a harness. When you're at the bottom, you barely notice that that harness is there. I mean, you can like move up and down laterally. You can even just unclip and walk out.
Right.
But the higher up you get, the tighter those strings get.
Really? Interesting. Okay.
And that's typically how I think about
it.
So, you know, I'm not denying that there are like very literal specific plants. We've seen that throughout history. They've been declassified documents, you know, that have illustrated this. That's not a mystery to anybody. But most of the time, I think what happens is it's the bigger a profile gets, whether that be a company, an entity, an organization, a person, then they have, there's more situational pressures on them. And the levers of power become stronger on them.
Right.
And so it's not necessarily that person is fully aware of like, oh my gosh, I'm aiding this, you know, really evil agenda. I'm, you know, totally with all of my heart, soul, and spirit, like I'm abetting this agenda. Most of the time, it's like they've got things that are right in front of them. Things tend to be very compartmentalized. And they have these situational pressure, there are various levers of power on them. And, you know, they're just going along, okay, what's the best decision I can make at this given time with the information I have?
Right.
You know, I think sometimes people do realize, oh, wait, I may be being used as a pawn. And it's at that point, they don't always know how to necessarily get out of it.
Exactly.
Either. Right. So, I mean, it's very complex. It's nuanced.
Yeah. It's like, it seems like maybe in the past, first industrial revolution or something like that, the point pressure points were very personal. Like there was somebody you knew, or they, you know, had that kind of thing. But now it's you know, to use the Daily Wire again, if their business model is to be on YouTube and Facebook, mm-hmm. well, who controls the algorithms on YouTube and Facebook? Right. Not the Daily Wire. If you want to, you know, use those things to rise your ship, so to speak, on the tide of like social change, right. you have to know how to capture the winds of the algorithm, basically. Right. And, you know, you're not in control of it and you don't even see it. So it's like, you know, that, yeah, anyway, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
So, do you want to get back to the Wilhelm Wundt and yeah, some other sure. stuff like that?
Back okay. to Wilhelm Wundt. I don't know that we should go too much more into him, but he's fascinating because of the whole Leipzig connection. As right. I mentioned, there were several students, right? Again, there's Granville Stanley Hall. He was the mentor to John Dewey, who was a co-author of the Humanist Manifesto in 1933.
That's an interesting one.
Right? There was a William James, E.M. Pavlov, Cattell, who was also very interesting. He was one of the first psych professors in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's really interesting about Wilhelm Wundt that I just like to mention is that his grandfather was Christian Rat Casimir Karl Wundt. Did I get that
that's
right?
That's a tongue twister.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
Yes. Christian Rat Karl Casimir Wundt. But the reason why he is significant is because he is known as Raphael on the Illuminati.
Okay.
And anybody who wants to find that can find it in the Utica Provincial Report, and that was in 1782. You can dig that up, and there's records.
I love that. I've heard you talk about that before, and it's fascinating because you know you'd think you know how would you know that this guy was Raphael in the Illuminati? But
there are several. That's one source. I have a book. It's called The Perfectibilis. And mm-hmm. that's actually what the Illuminati was called. And I think that's very, very telling because to me, that's the entire difference in the worldview around humanity.
Yeah.
You know, they believed that humans were, they could be perfected. And of course, it was just they were the ones who would be the ones to do it.
Yeah,
they can
better,
guide
right?
us. They knew how to perfect us.
Yeah.
Wow. And then people who think human beings are inherently flawed and want to, you know, help create systems to enhance and bring out the best of humanity, then mm-hmm. you know that kind of seems to be fundamental conflict.
Oh, big time. I mean, well, that's it. I mean, from a spiritual perspective, as somebody who studied a lot of psychology, and mm-hmm. you know, there is that I have recently started calling it the ontological singularity, meaning there's a place where all categories kind of all crescendo together, mm-hmm. and that place is above humanity. It's not humans can interact with it, they can see it, they can think about it. But that's above human, meaning it's a god. It's a godlike being, a transcendent being. And that's supposed to be, or at least when we human beings pursue those things above humanity, then we can actually achieve a kind of spiritual perfection. And we can become better than we are today by pursuing something better than us tomorrow. But if the thing we're pursuing is an AI god controlled by, you know, a bunch of globalists who decided this is the direction humanity needs to go for their own purposes, you know, I'm not so sure about that one.
Yeah.
So speaking of pursuing perfection, let's hear one of our amazing sponsors today.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and I'm here to tell you about my new product from MyPillow, towels that actually work. Watch this absorbency test. Here's another towel that we randomly went out and bought. Here's one of my towels with a nice design. I don't know if you can see this, but you could line a swimming pool with this. I mean, this is crazy. Get rid of it. Towels that actually work. What a concept. I'm interrupting this commercial to let you know you can get our six-piece my towels, regular $69.98, now only $29.98. Or you can save 25% on our brand new kitchen towels made with the same technology as our famous My Towels. Also, we have bath sheets, bath towels, washcloths, hand towels, and so much more. And the best part, with your promo code, your entire order ships absolutely free. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use that promo code to get deep discounts on all My Towels. And for a limited time, your order ships absolutely free.
Yeah.
All right. We are back. Don't forget to get yourself some MyPillow from Mike Lindell. Also, don't forget to check out those amazing products at Ascend Nutrition. You know, I've been taking the Pine Pollen Tincture for some time now. It really does improve your hormonal health. You've been taking it for a while too. Now you haven't been taking it, right?
I used it to sweeten up this coffee. Are you talking about the tincture?
Tincture.
No. No, really, I just take that because I'm a closet alcoholic. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. No, it's really great. So, all right. So getting back to.
Yeah.
we were talking about.
So Wilhelm von Trapp, I would say that the two really important things about him, remember I was saying that it's ironic because like the study of the soul, but he actually believed that you were devoid of spirit, devoid of soul, and devoid of self-determination. He believed that we were just, I mean, he was actually very, I think they estimated it was something like 53,000 pages of material.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's not a small, he's not an insignificant figure.
Right.
But he,
well, maybe he was a soulless automaton.
Prior to AI, right. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
But he believed that we were just like this collection of experiences and stimuli. Mm. So that is, I think just knowing that is very instrumental to understanding the influence that he had. You know, of course, he was the father of experimental psychology. So we now go from it. I think from the beginning of time, you know, I had written my ninth grade term paper on the pre-Socratic philosophers, and I called it a pre-Socratic philosopher search, man's search for primordial transcendence. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of really very intrinsic to humanity. We're always trying to understand who we are, what our purpose is, you know, what our place in the world is, why are we here? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very natural question. And I think the field of psychology, from the most benevolent kind of investigation, is really about that, is what are humans, and why are we here? Why do we think the way we think? Why do we feel the way we feel? But this is the beginning of, you took it out of things like philosophy, which are asking the questions, and, you know, and more investigative, explorative approach, to now it's experimental. You're taking it out of the, you know, academic type of realm, and placing it in, how do we, you know, isolate and study and experiment and potentially manipulate human beings. And he's really the progenitor of that.
The father of that. You know, it's funny. A lot of these people seem to be involved in occult groups, orders, things like this. And, you know, like to your point about him saying that we are kind of soulless. My question was that the shtick he was given to push onto the universities, or was that his real belief? You know, did you get any sense of what the difference is, if there was any?
I don't know. My sense, though, when you bring up like occult, so he's very interested in things like spiritualism, hypnotism, and of course Freud, Jung were as well. They studied the mystics. They wanted mind control, essentially. Right. They wanted power. And I don't necessarily mean that in the most dark, nefarious sense, but perhaps in a more egoistic sense. It was that, you know, if we could control the other person, then we could just bend them to our will. And I know that sounds really dark. I mean, I personally think that is a little dark. But I don't know that they saw it that way. I don't think they went into it like, I'm an evil, maniacal. I think it was more like, oh, well, we could help people if we could just get them to do things this way. And if we could just control their mind. So they were looking into things like mentalism, mind reading, a lot of, you know, hermetic principles. And
all is mind.
It's not, you know, I mean, I think even the, you know, original, you know, hermetic principles have been inverted and perverted. They've been mystified.
Well, I feel like there's some truth to them. Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. The original is, I think actually, I would agree. But I think they've inverted it, they've perverted it, they've mystified it to their purposes.
Yeah, and the original ones are totally compatible with whatever, you know, religion of choice you have too. Because they're really, you know, they don't deviate from anything. They can totally exist together.
It's a framework. Opposed to a belief. So that makes sense. So I don't know whether or not he was being pushed, but I think it's more that that's the world he was immersed in. So he was influenced by those people. I don't know that he was necessarily, I think, again, it comes back to that nuance, like who was funding him, who were his mentors. And I don't know if they specifically said like, hey, this is the narrative you got to push. But
It doesn't seem like it. So interesting.
So then we have Freud in 1886. He comes up with what's known as the talking cure. And that became the signature Tavistock method. That's, of course, like the talk therapy. But Freud also was really fascinated with, you know, the same kinds of mystical concepts and, you know, basically trying to figure out how we can read people's minds and control them. And he added drugs to the mix. He was obsessed with cocaine.
Really? Did he use that in his practice?
Yes, he did.
No kidding. That was like a big thing about Freud.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. both for himself and for his
well, why do they have such good conversations?
Yes, he was very involved in that. And Tavistock, I'm blanking on exactly where it was. It was later. But there was actually a conference where they were very instrumental in the creating this whole movement of using Ritalin for ADHD. There's a whole book on it. And it was really did come out of a Tavistock psychologist. Then we have 1885, the American Society for Psychical Research was founded. And they also helped found the Fabian Society.
Oh, the Fabian Society. Put in the chat if you know what the Fabian Society is. Put a one in the chat. I'm really curious.
Yeah, I would love to know how many people are.
So I'll give a little, you know, just a tidbit about the Fabian Society. So they're masters of incrementalism, right? Mm-hmm. The slow and steady wins the race. That's why their mascot is the tortoise. Slow and steady. But their coat of arms is the wolf in sheep's clothing. Right. And the wolf in sheep's clothing, I think, is a nod to the weaponization of the Hegelian dialectic. So the good cop, bad cop.
Right. Makes sense. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then July 4th of 1909, we have the Secret Intelligence Service, which later becomes the MI6. And I think that's relevant because Tavistock works very closely now with all Five Eyes. And they have, a lot of the members of Tavistock went on to the integral figures in a lot of the wartime research departments. So whether it be at RAND or Stanford Research Institute or MIT, but these are all wartime. And later, of course, John Rolling Reese, he writes his book. I have it here. I printed it out, but it's Shaping Psychiatry by War.
Whoa.
So basically just puts it all out there.
Yeah.
We'll do this wartime research and that is going to carve out the path for,
fascinating.
Social science.
So it seems like the origin was somewhere in the mid, let's say like 1860s, 1870s.
I think that's just setting the stage for the field of psychology.
That's why
I'd like people to understand, things don't happen in a vacuum.
Right.
So you have like all of these various things that are going on, that this Leipzig connection where like hundreds of PhDs are now being granted. There had never been a PhD before. Mm-hmm. It's, in my opinion, the of indoctrination. And you now have this whole new field that's emerging that was never conceptualized previously. And then you have things like the Fabian Society, where they're really talking about how are we going to create an internationalist world order. So you have then you have influences like Hegel, who are saying that the state is God and that we need to create an all-powerful state, an absolute state. This is just to set the stage for people. And then, of course, you have these very prominent figures like Freud and Jung, which most of the Tavistock psychologists were influenced by. So then it was September 1909, Freud and Jung visit William James, who, remember, was a student, a PhD of Wilhelm Wundt and known as the American father of psychology. And James was a founding member of the American Society for Psychical Research, and Freud and Jung were considered honorary. So then we get to the Lie Factory, the Wellington House. There's discrepancy in Dr. John Coleman's book, which was my introduction. Right. He says it is in 1913.
What was that one called?
The Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, Shaping the Moral, Spiritual, Cultural, Political, and Economic Decline of the United States of America. Now, when I first learned of it, it said "and Great Britain."
Oh,
so I don't know if
they just took that part out for some reason.
Either that, or that was a misprint the first time when I read it. I don't know. I don't claim to have the answer to that, but I thought it was interesting. So he says it really was in 1913. And Wikipedia says 1914. I'm going to go with Dr. John Coleman. So for those who are not familiar with Dr. John Coleman's work, he's written, I think, 13 books. He was former MI6. He's gotten a lot of critique. I think part of the critique is because he doesn't really cite his sources. I think there's a couple of reasons for this. One, I think, previously, if you were an academic, it was just you didn't, it was really the APA, actually, the American Psychological Association, that, codified that system of, you know, footnotes. And that's why they call it like the APA footnote.
Oh,
yeah.
That's fascinating. Okay. I didn't know that.
So it really was the field of psychology that, but prior to that, it was kind of a respected, you know, we trust that you did your research. And, you know, today it's very misleading. And, you know, often it's questionable if you don't have sources.
Right.
But he also was intelligence. And so former intelligence. And so considered a whistleblower. And a lot of his information was sources that he couldn't be revealed.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I know firsthand from friends of mine who were former intelligence that they have access to private libraries that, you know, like I wouldn't have, that I might be able to FOIA request for, but they can go to.
Right.
And or they have much easier access. I think they actually have access to some that we wouldn't need.
There's whole computer programs that have like libraries like that.
And, well, that's a whole, and that pisses me off. I mean, that's total gatekeeping, like racketeering scheme. Yeah, that's a whole nother, that's slightly different, but that pisses me off.
And then there's the, you know, the fraternities, like the Masonic lodges, they have ones that are just like libraries, you know, full of documents from hell, going way back.
Well, then there's the Vatican that nobody just completely locked up. But they, when you go into those libraries, the reason I brought it up is you go into those libraries and you can't take any pictures, you can't take any material out, but you can take notes. And those notes actually get redacted on your way out.
Get out of
here. So most of it comes from memory. Yeah.
Wow.
And so a lot of, it's part of why I happen to like his writing style, because it is from memory. It's very fluid. It's almost as if he's speaking. And I've listened to his speeches. So it's very much the way he speaks.
Okay.
So personally, I like reading that, but I understand the critique. So that's just my assessment of to answer some of the criticism. And I think it's fair. It's valid. Sure. I mean, everybody's memory is valuable, no matter how brilliant.
Yeah.
But I would trust his. There's the other book. There's only been two books, really, on Tavistock. I mean, there's been lots of, obviously, original sources from Tavistock. There's I actually have I printed out someone's dissertation on it, but
what is that one?
This is the Tavistock Institute Social Engineering for the Masses.
I think that's the one I have,
And this is Dan Estelin. He does a lot of quoting of Dr. John Coleman. He has some of his own analysis and synthesis as well. It's also an equally great book. But yeah, and then there was another source that I read that said 1912. So all of this to say it's somewhere around then.
Right. Okay.
But it was, again, because there was a German propaganda bureau. And so they cast the Harmsworth brothers, which would be Lord Rothmere and Lord Northcliffe. Northcliffe was married to the Rothschilds, was related to the Rothschild by marriage. And he was also the Daily Mail and... the other one.
I forget. You were sharing some of this. I think Daily Mail.
Was that?
It was definitely Daily Mail.
Who's the guy? You
were the British?
Go ahead.
Lord Northcliffe.
Northcliffe.
The E-Starter?
Yeah. I thought we were talking about it earlier, but...
I'll find it. Ahead, so the funding was provided, according to Dr. Coleman, by the British royal family, the Rothschilds, also, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which later became the Chatham House, which is kind of like the CFR, British, the counterpart to the CFR.
Right, right.
And Toynbee was a director there. He was the director of future studies there.
You know, it'd be cool because you have a series. He has a series called Men Behind the Curtain, which goes through a bunch of different cool things. You could do a pre-series that's called like Men Behind the Curtain Rods or something like that.
Well, that's the thing. I always use the analogy of like this is the cabal or deep state's brain are these think tanks, and the arms and legs are these foundations and nonprofits and charities that they use to facilitate the goals of the head. But the Tavistock is really like the frontal lobe or something, the part of it that's like...
I think of it as like the head of the octopus in many ways.
Yeah.
It's for the social engineering, for the culture creation. I mean, there's other heads, I would say, like the banking cartels, you know, that drive things. Like, obviously, people funded, the Rockefellers funded Tavistock.
Right, it was a Rockefeller grant that got it started, right?
The Rockefellers funded it before it became the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. They were involved in funding. But, yes, when it officially became Tavistock Institute of Human Relations in 1947, it was a Rockefeller grant that...
Because it was around since the 20s, right? Was that just the clinic?
The clinic was in the 20s.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
clinic was the 20s, and then the Institute of Human Relations, which is partnered. People always like to argue me, no, there's the natural health, the National Health Services,
right?
You know, the Portman, whatever.
Yeah. That's the modern.
Yeah, they're thing. Like, that's separate. I'm like, no.
That's probably where a lot of people first heard of the Tavistock.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm like, they work directly together, and we'll get to that. But that's that was 1947.
That's it.
Okay. So one is kind of the more private arm, and then one is the government arm. Yeah,
got
but
it.
they do work in tandem, and they are definitely connected. So then, as I mentioned before, Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays were appointed to handle the manipulation of the propaganda, essentially to get us into World War One. I thought this was very interesting, not, you know, pleasant, but, interesting. Bernays and Lippmann were very involved in, propaganda for the Federal Reserve Act, and the Federal Income Tax Act, the September 5th, 1913. Wilson called he called it a fight for the people and for free business. And he was so he was honored to have taken part in the completion of a great piece of business.
We need this to fight back against the money trust.
Right, yeah.
Well, really, what it was because there was a bill. It was the tariff adjustments, which really destroyed tariffs. And so now they weren't, and this was to pave the way for quote unquote free trade.
Right.
And at the time, this created, you know, the essentially slave labor in India.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's what paves the way for NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, sweatshops in China, all that right. production. But they knew what they were doing at the time.
Oh, sure.
And a lot of the propaganda for this was through Bernays and Lippmann. And they had they oversaw Wilson in, you know, creating the narrative that this was a good thing when, of course, this was devastating America.
What a time. It was like the golden age of propaganda. Like.
And they were just carrying out things that were like gamed out years, generations previous.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like
the American Cancer Association. Like, I mean, 1913 was quite a year.
No kidding.
Yeah. So that was all under Bernays and Lippmann. The adjust the tariffs was that part. And then, of course, in 1916, they weaponized the term isolationist. I talked about that. And it was, I'm trying to find what papers they had. I think it was the Daily Mirror? I know it was the Daily Mail was
Yes, correct.
Northbeth.
Okay.
But so then there was also, so it was essentially they had the German Propaganda Bureau, and then David Lloyd George, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, was given the task of setting up the British War Propaganda Bureau. And he appointed the writer and fellow liberal MP Charles Masterman to head this organization. And his quarters were set up at the Wellington House, which at the time was like a national insurance commission. He was the head of that.
Oh, I see.
And so the headquarters were, okay, here at the London headquarters of the National Insurance Commission, which Masterman was the chairman. And so what he did, and they say September 2nd, 1914. I don't know which year it was, if it was 13 or 14, but he invited 25 literary figures and to basically create like these pamphlets and journals and books for propaganda to help us get into the First World War.
Wow.
And these were very notable figures like Chesterton, H.G. Wells, of course, socialists, and Rudyard Kipling, who I was devastated to learn because I still maintain the poem "If" is the greatest poem of all time.
Well, it could still be, you know, maybe he didn't know what he was even getting into.
Right. Maybe. I'm going to give him.
Orwell, too, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure on Orwell, but Kipling, we're going to go with that.
There we go.
I don't know. They invited Kipling to the meeting. He actually couldn't come. So some of the other names were like Newbold, Thomas Hardy, Gilbert Parker, John Masefield, Arnold Bennett, Arthur Doyle, Hale Caine, William Archer. So like very, very prominent literary figure. Mm-hmm. And they kept this whole mission. They produced over 1,000, I think it was 1,160 pamphlets.
Wow.
Through the war, and they kept the whole mission secret until 1935.
So basically, just to recap all this for people, the First World War, which was at the, I mean, this was a massive, massive...
They called it the Great War at the time.
Yeah, they call it the Great War for a reason, because there was a lot happening. There were a lot of people involved. There was a lot of money interests. They were going to get a chance to use a lot of different tools and things like this. They were going to get to study the effects. So, you know, one thing I've noticed studying the globalists of today or yesteryear is that they, when they develop a project, they attach as many different things as they can to that project because they want to get the most out of it. And that period of time was not only a time of great, you know, destruction and mayhem because of the war itself, but also the advancement of the mass propaganda machine. I mean, I don't know when radio became a mass media operation. I think it was
in the 30s. And Cantrell was involved. Yep. And Rockefeller.
So they were developing their, you know, the agenda, like how are they going to use mass media? Because they had the radio way back when. They had electricity. They had all these tools that they were going to use, mm-hmm. just like they do today. What's
that? There's a volume issue. The sound went way down, apparently.
Okay. All right. Hold on 1 second, everybody.
People are asking if you've got this, all this information somewhere on the internet, if they want to dig more on it, like on your website or something.
Yeah. So I've done several shows, on it. So those are on my website. I have another one coming out on Tuesday. I did a radio show on it, but I filmed it. So I go through all that, but yeah, I would say my website, my Rumble channel. I don't have any of it necessarily written. I guess I could work on that.
I've been posting the PDFs of these books to your show.
Okay, yeah.
In chat. Sounds so good. That's probably a good place to start if you can hear me.
Yeah, definitely. Well, sounds good now, everybody. Nice. So I was just leading up to the fact that, you know, think about the way the computer was developed. The computer was, the basic components of the computer was developed in the 40s. But we didn't have the computer age until, 50 years later, right?
Under ARPA.
Yeah, under ARPA.
Which became DARPA.
Exactly. So what I'm getting at is, you know, when you live in a globalist controlled world, new technology, you know, we like to think, oh, well, somebody invents a new machine, you know, and next year they're out making all this money from it. That's not the way it works. No. If a new machine is going to get invented or a new technology, it needs to be unfolded in the grand agenda. And there's like a 50-year turnaround time or something like that. So all of these things that we were about to see with mass media and radio, and then all of the effects of that, they were like building up their intelligence assets for.
Oh, yeah. It just so happens that all the biggest things that we use on the internet are connected to DARPA somehow today. So it's like they had years to game out the evolution of technology, it seems like.
Right. Like LifeLog, which shut down February 4th, 2004. Facebook went up February 4th, 2004.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a coincidence.
Oh, it's just a coincidence.
LifeLog was shut down. They deemed it a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Mm. But Facebook was an opt-in program.
Oh, because you opted in, right. Fascinating. Those terms of services. So,
manufacturing consent.
Exactly.
Yeah, which was Edward Bernays' term, right? Mm. And that was one of the other things he did when he was overseeing Wilson, is he taught him about polling. And they do call that manufacturing consent,
right?
Or opinion making.
Because the poll itself, just the act of taking the poll, would itself shape your opinions,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. Okay. Well, and also because the collection of the poll, right? So, polls. One of the things I've learned about statistics, I had to teach myself statistics in high school because I wrote 285 page theses on dream analysis.
Oh, wow.
So I had to, I have statistics, right? So I had to teach myself. And I remember I told my mom, I said, so basically statistics is just you manipulate numbers to prove your hypothesis. And my mom was like, Courtney, no, that's not how that works. And I said, oh, no. That's
exactly how it works. Yeah.
And I later learned, I think the founder of statistics actually said something to that.
Right.
I don't remember his exact quote, but basically.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's how studies work. It's like they decide on the outcome before, then they just tweak all of the controls to produce the results they're looking for.
Right.
Well, if it wasn't, intentional, I mean, think about it. You're subconsciously, you want to prove your hypothesis. So you're going to kind of self-select for things that will point you in that direction. And you're going to kind of gear it that way, even if you're not intentionally manipulating it.
Right. Exactly.
And it was confirmation bias.
That's it. We're going to do a promo here in a second, but before we do, I wanted to ask you a question about this whole period, because I'm trying to figure out, like, do you think that these events were, like World War One, for example, was that an event that needed propaganda to be successful, or was that itself almost like a beta test for the propaganda they wanted to roll out?
No. They needed, I mean, Woodrow Wilson literally ran on the campaign that he would not get us into war. They absolutely needed the propaganda.
Right. Okay.
I do not think that the British people were not psyched about it. The Americans, and that's what they needed. They needed the Americans and the Britons to
be in the yeah. Wow. Interesting. Fascinating.
So, and they also needed, you know, the whole Federal Reserve bailout.
Right.
And that was a huge part of it. We wouldn't have had the funding to go into World War One.
You're right. Yeah.
They needed the money.
They needed the money, and they had a whole psyop about the banking sector and the ending the free banking era,
right?
Up to that, which was the panic of 1907. So it's like, it's very interesting the way these events happen that all of a sudden seem like panics or problems that, and then miraculously they use perfectly to move agendas down the line. You know?
Yeah. So, well, and then the Tavistock engineers talk about these different things, like, you know, they talk about crises and how, and crisis management, and Fred Emery is one much later, but he calls it SET, which is a situational environmental something. I'll find it. But but it's essentially like out of these crises, how you can control people. Oh, and he calls it segmentation. So out of these crises, and we saw this all through COVID, you get these like fragmented groups.
Oh, yes. Yeah. COVID was a masterpiece of that. All right, Ryan, let's hear from one of our lovely and amazing sponsors here.
Are you guys ready to diversify your assets with Bitcoin? You got to check out River, the official Bitcoin partner of Badlands Media, where you can navigate the world of Bitcoin with confidence. With River, you can buy Bitcoin like a pro. I did. It was very easy. It's the simplest thing involving crypto that I've ever done personally. With the insurance of being licensed and regulated right here in the United States. River ensures your Bitcoin journey is smooth and secure with on-demand live support at your fingertips. River empowers you to grow your portfolio without any unwanted surprises and eliminates the third-party custodians, putting you directly in control of your own assets. Open an account with no minimum purchase requirement. You can get your Bitcoin journey started with just $1. And then, you know, you can, what I did is I signed up every week, $20 goes out of my bank account. It's invested in Bitcoin. I don't even think about it. And then I'll go check it and like, oh, look at all this money. So that's kind of how it works. And I would definitely recommend not checking it every day. Just let it build up. Don't touch it. Just let it sit there if you have the money to spare. Yeah.
Right.
So open an account with no minimum purchase requirement. You can get your Bitcoin journey started with just $1. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/river to create your River account today. That's badlandsmedia.tv/river. River, shaping the future of finance, one Bitcoin at a time.
Excellent. All right. Yeah, definitely check it out, everybody. Ryan has been using it. He's been ranting and raving about it. I know G Money would be very happy if.
Yeah, I did it for G.
Yeah. So, all right, we have a question from Marcy USA, and Marcy asks, we're so far down the global agenda. What are your thoughts on how or what can be done to turn things around in this nightmare?
I think a lot of things can be done. I just wanted to correct something I said. Social emotional, social environmental turbulence is what it's called.
Okay.
And where did I have that?
No problem.
Social environmental turbulence. It was SET.
SET,
That's Fred Emery. What do I think can be done? I think a lot of things can be done. I think that like psyops are a lot less effective if people are aware that they're than all.
Right.
So. I that's part of why I inform people, you know, as best I can, because I think that if people know that there's an off, whether we're still, none of us are impervious to programming.
Right. Oh, yeah.
That we'll still be somewhat susceptible, but I think they don't have the same power over us. So I think that there's a lot of linchpins. So their ultimate goal is to put us literally in a digital gulag. They want to put us in a digital prison. You know, I talked about the AI world society. Those are their goals. And I think that can't really work without digital currency.
Right.
It can't work without the CBDCs.
Yeah.
So I think that's a huge bulwark. If we just at the local level do whatever we can to push against that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we can push it in favor of something that is backed by, that is not a fiat currency, that's better.
Right.
But even if it's not, as long as it's not a surveillance, you know, metric of currency.
Digital identification, same concept.
Without the digital ID and the digital, currency, they don't even, so China has a social credit system. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with that. They call it the value reward system, social value reward.
Oh my God.
And I think that they've caught on that people know what the social credit system is.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds better. It sounds more meritocratic,
right.
But it's the same thing. And that, you know, if you don't have those things implemented, if you don't have digital currency, if we're not on UBI, if we're not, we don't all have these digital IDs where they're taking. So I think those things can be stopped.
Sure.
They can at least be opted out of. And then, I think whatever people can do to achieve their personal sovereignty is going to look different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think all of those things are ways that we can resist. You know, these are their plans. And the great thing about plans is, the saying of best laid plans of mice and men, is plans can be derailed.
Yes.
And I think we actually have derailed some of them. So people are waking up at a rapid rate. I was a complete normie and totally asleep a few years ago. I mean, I had no clue. I'd never heard of Tavistock, just for starters. I was very immersed in the world of psychology. I actually almost got my degree. I almost went for a master's at Columbia in organizational psychology, and the whole field of organizational psychology was created by Tavistock. And the purpose of it was to create these public-private partnerships to implement the technocracy.
Wow.
It was all about creating this global, corporate fascist technocratic takeover. Mm-hmm. That's what they were building with the with organizations.
I mean, it makes so much sense. There's, part of their whole linchpin, if you look at the way their planning works, is participation. We're in a participation prison in the sense that we have to choose to participate.
Yes.
And ultimately, as much as they would like to, develop a perfect technology where that we can be totally mind controlled, either that's not possible or they're not doing it for whatever reason. Right. I'm inclined to believe it's more the former than the latter. And I think, like you were saying, a PSYOP has to, there's a certain degree of unconsciousness that needs to be there for a PSYOP to work. I'm sure you're aware of the Ash conformity experiments, which were about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You probably have, but you don't realize they're called.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So if they did these experiments where they'd get 20 people in a classroom and the teacher would draw two lines on the chalkboard. Two of them were, they were clearly the same size, but they'd ask everybody in the classroom how big, which line is bigger, A or B. And everybody in the classroom would answer B. And the person who was the test subject, who was the only one who wasn't in on the experiment, would be like, what? It's not, they're not the same, but they wouldn't say anything. They would just go along with the whole group. But as soon as one person would step out and be like, well, clearly this isn't right.
Yeah.
Then the subject would be like, yeah, you're right. So they were just looking for a reason to choose something that conformed with their truth.
It's very sad. I remember Paul did something like that where he had everybody touch their, I don't remember if it was touch your cheek, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was touch your nose. And everybody was touching the, but he said, touch your cheek.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it was the opposite.
Something like that.
He said it was, but he demonstrated and everybody just did what he demonstrated. And I remember being so confused. I'm hearing impaired. So I assumed I heard it wrong. Why is everybody
touching their cheek?
Yeah. And I was like, he didn't say to do that.
Right.
It was just what he did.
That reminds me of when we were all at Clay's event a couple of weeks back, and Boone Cutler is like, raise your hand if you're upset about them arresting General Flynn. And then everybody in the room raised their hand. And he's like, well, he was never arrested.
Exactly.
That was a perfect example. That was so wild. I remember seeing that and being like, oh, my God.
I know. Well, we'll get back into the history here. But I think it's really important to understand that, these systems require you to be tuned out. They require you to be zoned out on your phone, the TV, your favorite podcast. It really doesn't matter what. And I think that's why they're not as militant about what exactly media comes out now as they were maybe in the past, because while you're zoning out, you're still being guided quietly along to mouse track. So yeah,
that's true.
Okay, so what's next?
So there was a book called The Climax of Civilization in 1917.
Okay.
And that was by Corea Moylan Walsh. And the Wellington Health Board members, Rothmere, Northcliffe, Lipman, and Bernays had all read it. And they proposed that they use that as a guide. Mm-hmm. And that book actually later became very much kind of the guide for the Club of Rome, the principles of the Club of Rome.
No kidding. Okay.
They later decided to use a Spengler. This was much later, in 1937. Spengler's book, The Decline of Western Civilization. Mm-hmm. And he had this idea, essentially, that alien elements would be introduced to Western civilization in increasing numbers, and the West would fail at a time to expel the alien. Thereby, this is according to Dr. John Coleman, thereby sealing its fate, a society whose inward beliefs and sound convictions would become at variance with its outward profession. And thus the Western civilization would fall by the wayside in the manner of the ancient civilizations of Greece and Rome.
Volume again, I guess.
Volume? Oh. That's weird. Ever since I'm in my head.
Yeah, let us know if you can hear us, guys.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sting.
Yeah. Volume went too far down. That's weird. Okay. Well.
Happened a couple times.
Good old StreamYard. Okay.
Happy Easter, everybody, by the way.
Everything looks clear on my end. Well, let's just go ahead and keep going.
Yeah.
Okay. Tavistock thinking was that Spengler had indoctrinated the Western civilization to believe that it would err on the side of the Roman civilization and expel the alien. But they believed that the Tavistock engineer believed that basically there was too much genetic loss. You know, they were eugenicists, essentially. And so, of course, they believed the solution would be to usher in their new world order rather than letting the natural train of events to occur. So let me see. So they also weaponized terms like regime change, collateral change, that became huge propaganda buzzwords.
Oh, yeah.
And then they even, because they were overseeing Wilson, you know, when he wrote the book. He didn't write it. Hale did, but he touted the new freedom. Which was, he was the first president to use the term the New World Order.
Are you familiar with Mendel House?
Yes.
Okay, how does he fit into any of this? Because I know he was heavily influencing.
He was part of the whole Federal Reserve Act. So it was Mendel House, Sam Undermeyer, who was he also helped with the Federal Reserve Act. I'm trying to remember exactly what Mendel House's role was, but it was related to the Federal Reserve Act.
And the creation of the CFR.
Right.
He wrote the book Philip Drew, Administrator, and gave a copy to Woodrow Wilson to kind of plant ideas into his head about these things. Yeah. And you guys better be using WikiSpooks or Wikipedia to look up every single name that we have mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to want a full report next week.
Yeah, there's going to be a quiz next week. We're also going to have a raffle to see how many people can remember all the various names we mentioned on the show today. So so don't forget to do that. And, you know, if you're struggling to keep all the names in mind, don't worry. Courtney's going to be back to talk a lot about this stuff and more. So, and don't forget to check out her channels if you're curious about where you can find Courtney's information. Don't forget, you can check in the links in the description. And let's see. Okay, the description hasn't been updated yet. Okay, well, if you're listening to this interview, then you can check the links in the description after it's already aired. I'm going to go ahead and place the links.
Oh, really?
In the... in the comment section for you guys, so you can grab that. So, what's going on?
Nothing. Just
okay.
Some technical shenanigans.
There's never any technical shenanigans happening ever. I promise. So
real quick, do we want to talk about how we met, Courtney? Did you guys go over that?
No, I don't. Go ahead and get into the story.
Well, I first met Courtney at the first Clay Clark podcaster.
That's what I thought.
Thing that they did.
That's where we met. Right?
Yeah, me and Paul. I don't know what you were doing, but me and Paul were getting in line to get burgers,
mm-hmm.
and they were in front of us, and then we just started yakking.
Nice.
And that's then awesome. We get halfway through the line and Daryl Flynn comes up and he's in behind us. It was such a weird, like, I remember this time so well.
Yeah. It was great. I mean, we just came back from one and they're always really great. I kind of wish there was like the event itself and then we all got like a few days just to hang out and have like a powwow amongst podcasters, at least the people that want to participate. So, all right. So everybody, if you are watching live on Rumble, go into the comment section. You should see all of Courtney's various socials. Like you can go to her website, CourtneyTurner.com. You can go to her Twitter, True Social, Instagram, Telegram, and CrowdRank. So check that out.
We call it CrowDrank.
CrowDrank, yeah.
CrowDrank.
Just the joke, but yeah. It is CrowDrank.
CrowDrank,
yeah. So awesome. Okay, so let's see. We're about an hour and a half in. So why don't we, let's see how far we can get. Can we get up to the introduction of mass media as we know it, do you think? Or what intervening steps do you think that we should talk about
first? Yeah, we could. I mean, I think right now the next would probably be a Tavistock Clinic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So we have the Tavistock Clinic, which was named after the 11th Marquis, the Duke of Tavistock.
Duke of Tavistock. And
he was related to, I think it was William Russell, who was co-founder of Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
With
the Russell Trust. Yeah.
Yes. The Russell Trust. Right. And Alphonse Taft was related to President Taft.
Mm.
So these were the people who founded Skull and Bones.
Right.
Yeah, so he donated. It was specifically designated for shell shock therapy research.
Yeah, it was like a neurosis in soldiers, but then also the greater population was kind of there.
Well, they had originally intended only to keep it open for 3 years, and instead of closing down, it ended up really growing. And they used it initially to study shell shock therapy, post traumatic stress for soldiers, but then they realized they could calculate what the breaking points were. So they decided to do experiments on how to create it. Mm. So essentially it got weaponized.
Wow. No kidding. I wonder what the public sentiment of the Tavistock was back in the day.
It was so prestigious.
I'm sure all this excellent like doing lectures. Good thing, you know, like, you know.
Well, they marketed, I think a thing for people to really understand, and this is true of the whole field of social science, is they really marketed it as, this is a hard science. It was considered very prestigious. And I think that's part of what all of the experimentation was about. Like, this is a real science. But a lot of the techniques they're using were not scientific at all.
Right.
You know, they're very mystical. They're not quantifiable. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are not, you know, one of the tests of science is to be able to, you know, the repeatability and replication of the experiment itself and the controlled mechanism controlled. And that was not the case with a lot of the sciences. So,
no, you're right. Yeah. It's almost like there's a data gathering operation and all the real science, if I can even call it that, is happening behind the scenes.
Right.
You know, intelligence agencies that we can't see, something like that. So,
totally.
Interesting.
So, it saw its first patient September 27th of 1920.
It's the Tavistock Institute.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The clinic.
Established by Hugh Creighton Miller,
mm-hmm.
with contributions from several wealthy donors to start off. They only had 7 doctors in the very beginning.
Wow.
It was very small. And then by the end of the 1920s, the building wasn't big enough, so they actually moved. And this was John Rowling Reese had been the deputy director since 1926. He established an extension fund called the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology to raise money for a new premises. And then on August 9th of 1929, they formally incorporated that. And he coined like the Tavistock method. Mm-hmm. And if you'll remember, he's the one who wrote that book, Shaping of Psychiatry by War. I've got all sorts of great quotes by him. He was also the creator of the National Training Labs, the research for the Institute for Social Research in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And the T Lab in MIT. And then this is just a quote, the Tavistock method that Reese developed induces control stress via what Reese calls psychologically controlled environments in order to make people give up their firmly held beliefs under peer pressure. He claimed that we can therefore justifiably stress our particular point of view with regard to the proper development of the human psyche, even though our knowledge may be incomplete. We must aim to make it permeate every educational activity of our national life. And I have another quote that I'm going to read because I will not, I'll butcher it, but try to do it from memory. But it's essentially when he talks about how their fifth columnists, public life, politics, and industry, should all of them be within our sphere of influence. If we are to infiltrate the professional and social activities of other people, I think we must imitate the totalitarians and organize some kind of fifth column activity. If better ideas on mental health are to progress and spread, we as the salesmen must lose our identity. Let us all, therefore, be very secretly fifth column.
Wow. So it reminds me of a couple different things. Obviously, the whole fifth column reference, you know, we can get into that in a minute. But the idea that we have to take on the skin or the visage of other people, it also reminds me of the Club of Rome and the wolf in sheep clothing thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a group, I'm sure I've mentioned it to you, the Sabbateans in 1666. Yeah. And they would literally, like, you know, we're going to become Christians, we're going to become atheists, we're going to become these
Islamists.
But in reality, they would secretly practice their twisted form of Judaism that they had developed. So,
yeah,
very similar types.
It was only 200 years after, was it Levi? But it was another false messiah.
Yeah. Oh, Eliphas Levi or something?
Yeah.
Another Freemason.
Wow.
Among other things, Rosicrucian.
This is one other, and this is from Shaping of Psychiatry by War. Okay. He says, war is a valuable testing. This is what I see throughout everything.
Mm-hmm.
War is a valuable testing ground for the most of us. And certainly this is true of psychiatrists.
Wow.
Yeah.
Psychology is war.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything about modern warfare. Yeah,
it is. Exactly. I mean, if you really, especially if you read any military writings on war or intelligence adjacent writings on war, war is not necessarily picking up a gun and trying to kill somebody next to you. It's a battle between values and whether or not you have the power to force your values unilaterally on somebody else. And so in that sense, war can be declared without ever firing
a shot.
Exactly.
What was the book? I think it was Kurt Lewin who wrote, The Battle of the Mind.
I'll find the PDF and
book. I think it was Lewin. Mind.
Joyce Meyer?
No. Think it was Lewin.
I'm seeing Joyce Meyer. Oh, this is Battlefield of the Mind. Oh, yeah. Something totally different.
I'm seeing that too. Battle for the Mind.
Battle for the Mind. Okay. Yeah, a lot of people are just horrified, but the degree to which our universities and institutions have been, you know, corrupted. But I don't know if they ever started off good necessarily. Certainly in the past 100 years or so, this whole idea of universities is something that harkens back to the scholastics, which started off, God, that was like 900 AD or something like that.
Yes. Oh, it's William Sargent. That's what
William
it was.
Sargent.
I found it
with Kurt Lewin. Yeah.
I'm going to put the PDF in the chat for y'all.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Check out the chat, everybody.
And a good book, if people want kind of the history of how the academic institutions were infiltrated, would be Cloak and Gown.
Cloak and Gown.
I would also say Anthony Sutton's Order of Skull and Bones, because he talks a lot about, it's not just Yale. They have ties to Johns Hopkins.
Oh, yeah, the Ivy League.
Cornell. It was Daniel Coit Gilman who was, he set up the Russell Trust.
Which is huge, right?
But, yeah.
They're huge with everything.
He set up the Russell Trust, but he had ties to Johns Hopkins, and he actually was instrumental in getting Lincoln to sign the Morrill Land Act, which is what gave college grants, like the colleges land grants, and that was for Cornell and Yale initially.
Wow, no kidding. So, yeah,
I think it was 1862.
All these universities, you know, or at least a good chunk of them, certainly the ones that are propped up in the mainstream, are part of this operation.
Totally.
Undoubtedly.
Well, they have to indoctrinate people to create their useful idiots and their assets.
Right. So when 90% of the population is severely indoctrinated by people who have no problem pushing their worldview to penetrate your own, can you really have a democracy?
Well, you can, because democracy is mob rule. So
right, yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So, I think that's okay. Essentially. So then we have 1921, the Marquis of Tavistock, and as I mentioned, he was the one who donated the building for the shell shock therapy research. He was, in addition to being related to William Huntington Russell, who co-founded the Order of Skull and Bones, he was also Order of Knight, Order of St. John Knight, Knights of Grace, Order of Garter.
Oh, the Holy Order of the Garters.
Yeah.
Fellow of the Royal Society. And then a couple of others I'm just not familiar with. But yeah, he seemed to have many memberships.
Right.
And then Bowlby and Sargent at the same time were conducting research at Maudsley Hospital under Mapother, the Institute of Psychiatry. And they were doing insulin shock therapy.
Insulin shock. Okay. What's that about?
That was like where they insulin induced coma.
Oh, I see. Okay. Jeez. Wow. So literally depriving the body of blood sugar. Fascinating.
And Sargent was the one who wrote the Battle for the Mind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then Bowlby was the one who did the attachment studies. Mm. So like where they left the children, it's a horrifying studies.
No,
he was the father of attachment theory.
Yeah.
But where they would leave the children, give them all their physical needs, like, you know, their, food, water, all of right. that. But did not touch them and engage with them. Wow. And every child died.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's right. How old were the children?
Infants.
Infants. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Infants.
Touch is very important. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Apparently it is life-saving.
Right. So my God.
Then we have 1922, and this is when Kurt Lewin comes into the picture. He was one of the Frankfurt School refugees. So there's a lot of overlap between the Frankfurt School and Tavistock. Mm-hmm. A lot of the members were quote unquote refugees because a lot of them were Jewish and a lot of them had left, mm-hmm. Frankfurt School because of what was going on with Nazi Germany.
Right.
And they went to work at Tavistock, and Kurt Lewin was one of them. And he became the director in 1922. He also set up the Harvard Psychology Clinic that originated the propaganda campaign to turn the American public against Germany and involved in World War II. Mm-hmm. So I do not think they could, without all this propaganda, I don't think they could have.
Right. It's interesting. I'm sure you've heard of Operation Paperclip before. It's pretty well known.
Right? Yes.
Well, it sounds like there was a British version of Paperclip in the sense that the Frankfurt School had to get cleared out. And then where did all these people go?
A lot of them went to Tavistock, but there's also a lot of them then came to the United States, right? They set up the Institute for Social Research at Columbia University at Michigan. They also set up the A.K. Rice Institute, and that I've had the dates, but I would have to find them. When that was, it was a little bit later, I want to say in the 30s or 40s, I'll find it, sure. But A.K. Rice, and that was based on Wilfred Bion's work and sensitivity training of Lewin. Wow. And it was considered the American offshoot of Tavistock in Great Britain. So it's kind of like their headquarters here in the United States. And of course, there's several offshoots throughout there because all of these think tanks essentially work through, Tavistock works through them. So they work with the Rand Institute, they work with Stanford Research Institute, MIT, a lot of them.
They're all in bed together, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of them, yeah. So he was known as the father of social psychology, organizational and applied psychology. He was a proponent of, he created the Center for Group Dynamics at MIT, the National Training Labs, Research Labs. He was a proponent of Gestalt therapy, and Gestalt was very much what led to like the Esalen group therapy programs.
Okay.
The human potential movement.
Right.
What else was there? But actually there was a CIA document with, they called it the, what do they call it? Like Esalen Hot Tub Diplomacy. That's what it was.
Oh, right. Yes, I've heard about it.
It was about how they use the S retreats to create like cold like relations with the Soviets. They're trying to create diplomacy. That's essentially this idea that, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are going to
save the world.
But it is also what spawned things like Landmark Forum. So a lot of people may be familiar with, are you familiar with Landmark Forum?
No.
So Landmark has many offshoots, but Landmark is probably the most well-known because they're the most structured. Like they actually have courses that they're kind of like, you can look up the courses online, but there are all these offshoots. I've actually done two of them.
It's personal development forum.
Yes. They're personal, personal development. And they are totally communist brainwashing. Wow. I know firsthand because I was there. and they, when you walk in and out of each, like, each class, they have you hold hands and listen to the song Imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, if you need any more proof that the song Imagine is like a communist ode, I don't know what, you know, what else.
Totally. But sensitivity training,
that's so weird.
You know, sensitivity training is gotten very, people are very familiar with it now because of the corporate sensitivity training.
Right.
The DEI sensitivity training. But this came out of National Training Labs and they actually called it brainwashing. Called it brainwashing. So
it wasn't such a bad term, I guess, back then.
I know, right?
You have this much psychic baggage.
The definition of sensitivity training: group meetings, large or small, to discuss publicly intimate and personal matters, the opinions and values or beliefs, and or to act out emotions and feelings towards one another in the group using techniques of self-confession and mutual criticism. Also, coercive persuasion in the form of thought reform or brainwashing. And that second quote, coercive persuasion in the form of thought reform or brainwashing, is straight out of page 47, Issues in Training in 1962. And this is the National Training Laboratory manual. But when I was explaining what it is, this is exactly what these group dynamic, like personal development forums would do. Mm-hmm. You're in these groups. Sometimes they're not that small. Like they're pretty big and you divulge like your darkest, deepest secrets, your trauma. And now it's a way of stripping your own personal identity.
Yes.
And you bond. It's trauma bonding, yep. Right? You bond with 100%. These groups and you lose yourself. And then you know, things that you may have held dear and, you know, were a core part of your identity and your self-perception now get blurred into this group identity. And they also have levers of power over you. This is how they can blackmail you. They can, right?
It's almost like the negative polarization of group therapy, which we have found is super beneficial to specifically people who've been through like SRA and things like this. But then like polarization in all things that can also be used for ill. It sounds like exactly what you're
saying.
Well, yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to say that. And, you know, to go off on like a 60 second rant real quick, like, so I've been developing a model psychology for like over 20 years. And one of the things I discovered is something I call intellectual intimacy. So intellectual intimacy is kind of like you're as a being, you're constantly generating opinions and thoughts about your experience, the world, whatnot. And what's supposed to happen at a sociological level is that you're supposed to share that with people. You open up as a person and then you feel, and this has a central nervous system effect. You can literally measure it. You feel like you're being vulnerable. It's like it literally takes the egg of you and kind of cracks it open for a moment. And when you share that with another person and they actually are vulnerable with you, then you get this whole, like you were saying, like a blending of personalities kind of effect that's happening. And it's supposed to be a part of what I think is a healthy, you know, relationship with another person, whether it's your significant other, your father,
your community,
something like this. So for healthy communities, especially ones that have healthy intellectual intimacy, people are a lot healthier. They don't have nearly as many psychological issues. They don't have nearly as many central nervous system disorders or diseases. But to your point, Ryan, and to what we've been talking about, they spent how long through whether it was religious socialization culture or the post-religious aspect of isolating people? You know, it's not okay to talk about your opinions. What is it? you know, what most people don't want to do today is talk about politics, because politics is a no-no. You can't talk about politics. But politics, if you think about the category of politics, it's what you believe and value, which is some of the most intimate aspects of your personality. So they isolate people. And then because they're all isolated, they create these focus groups, these, what are they called? Socialization, sensitivity.
Segmentation. There's a national training lab, the sensitivity training. But then later, Emory talks about segmentation, which is a result of SET, which is the situational environmental turbulence.
Okay. So exactly. So you create, they isolate people.
Social environmental turbulence.
But then once these people have been sufficiently isolated and they feel like they can't talk to each other, which rigidifies their personality, you cause that to open up in a controlled setting that you can manipulate. And now people walk out of that being brainwashed. I mean, it's brilliant.
We're brainwashing.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think just this is a slight, you know, tangent, but I think it's very relevant, is that what you're talking about is this beautiful interplay of, you know, the individual experience, the individual, the core of what it means to be a unique individual, and then having that shared interconnectedness with others, right? You experience, you know, the other people or other or in a group, and this it both has an impact on you as well as a ripple effect, you know, collectively,
right?
And what they do, they create this duality, essentially. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, the core of theosophy, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a religious group cult.
Right.
And it's this idea that, you know, everything is one. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, you know, that's one of the quintessential lies. And it's a lie because it's marrying a truth to it.
Right.
And that's the most deceptive. And the reason for that is because, yes, there is. I think it's undeniable that there is, you know, Jung talks about a collective unconscious. There's all these different. And I think there absolutely is. We can't deny that we're all interconnected. We can't deny that there's ripple effects from, you know, one step, one action. You know, one rock has literally a ripple effect in a lake, right? You see that. But that doesn't negate the individual.
Right.
It doesn't negate their value and the uniqueness of them. And it's really that interplay that makes, to me, it's the most beautiful thing about the human experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what they want to take away, is you're stripping the individual identity. I think, and I've had this theory for such a long time, that they've actually, I know they've talked about MKUltra declassified documents, we'll talk about this, where they have studied dark triad personality disorder, and they found ways where they could not only enhance them, but actually create them.
What was it? What was the name of the disorder?
Dark triad personality disorders.
Yeah.
So that would be like a Machiavellianism, narcissism, and psychopathy.
Yeah.
I would add that I think they've also created borderline personality disorders. And, you know, I think part of our culture has really exacerbated borderline tendency. And we go back to Bowlby, right? He was doing all these attachment theory studies. Mm-hmm. And so he understood that anxious ambivalent attachment usually leads to, it leads to something called RAD, which is like reactionary attention disorder. Mm-hmm. And that they found a direct correlation to, do anxious ambivalent attachment and borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they know that. And that's part of what happens when you start creating like a destruction of the family, when you do all this gender bending and blurring, when you destroy any sense of logic and reason and anchors. Really, people need anchors. We need something that we can count on, something that we know to be true, something to measure up our perception, our beliefs against the world, to even if we don't have access to like arbitrary, you know, absolute truth. I believe there is absolute truth, but we may not always be privy to what the truth may be, but we need some sort of anchors to be able to assess it and to even aim at it. And if we can't orient ourselves towards it, it's complete chaos. And chaos is a breeding ground for usurpation of power, but it's also lends itself to these attachment disorders that can propagate borderline personality disorder. And I think a society of borderlines, you know, who don't have identity, are much more susceptible to manipulation.
I mean, that's spot on. I couldn't agree more. I mean, it seems like the the introduction, I posit it's the introduction of the cell phone, and particularly in saturation media. I mean, prior to cable, you know, we had, there was a lot of media, don't get me wrong, but like there was a lot more socialization happening, you know. Like I wasn't alive back then, but hearing my parents talk about it, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then right around the early 80s, we had saturation media. You had video games, cable, and now cell phones, and it's so
junk food media.
Yeah, it, you know, most people. One of the statistics I was researching for the talk I gave at the last Clay Clark was that a child today will watch 7.5 hours of media and only get 30 minutes of FaceTime with their parents.
Well, that's bad, but it's not just media in general that's the problem. It's the junk food media of today.
Sure.
Imagine being saturated in stuff that taught you about how to respect your parents and like all these other things. But we just live in a society where that stuff doesn't exist.
Yeah, you need the social, to your point, you know, you need socialization. It's like, you could, even if you had the best media in the world, if you don't know that socialization interplay to suss it out, you know, how do you really know?
Real human socialization.
Yes.
Like blur kind of a boundary, you know, dissolution kind of
exactly
a socialization. The example I use, and the 80s are a good example of this, but you had this, you know, just massive media boom, and we've always had like images. I don't know if men can relate to this as much, but women will definitely get this. But you know, where you would see all these figures like in the magazines and, you know, in films and whatnot, these icons. And but when you stepped out into the world, and I grew up right outside New York City, so I mean, I would actually see celebrities, you know. Oh, yeah. When you see them in real life, you realize, oh, okay, so this picture is not quite what they look like. Even if you didn't see them, you would see real people every day, and you'd have something to measure up. Okay, well, this is not the picture of reality.
Right.
And you had some sort of, but now everybody is, it's their phone, and so you have an algorithm, and it's a negative feedback loop.
Yes.
And they have nothing to measure against. They're not seeing what reality is. So it's literal reality wars.
Yes.
And that's what they're priming us for, is to put us into a metaverse. And when you start looking, so when you look at the, and I know we're going to do this as an ongoing, but when you look at the Tavistock website right now, it's I mean, they're not hiding anything. They talk about it being an awakening organization, and that they're recruiting Gnostic reticulous. Literally say this.
I can't wait Gnostic to get into
reticulous.
That
reticulous, I mean, it's a term like to cast a net, so it gets it's like the structuring of Gnosticism.
Okay,
look at when I was talking before, you know, earlier about the AI world society, and this is the UN 100, the underpinnings of the UN is the Lucius Trust. That's literally the
soul. I know. We've been looking into that lately.
And the Lucius Trust was created by Alice Bailey, who was the disciple of
Theosophy,
who popularized the Theosophical movement. I don't think she created it. I think, you know, she popularized it.
Naval intelligence was involved.
Yeah. And so she created this. It was her brainchild, this Lucius Trust, along with like the Arcane Society. And then there's several different branches. But her original company was called Lucifer Publishing.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, a little bit too on the news.
Yeah, wasn't it Lucifer Trust at first? And then they changed it?
Publishing. It was American Publishing. This is right on their website. This is not like, people argue with me all the time on this. And I'm like, go to their website. Literally, it's right out there for everybody to read. Mm-hmm. They talk about the world. They have this like a week festival. And it's a festival of world servers. So they literally talk about how like these people are going to be part of their world servers, which is right in alignment with everything they're doing with education, to put every child in a computer, to create people who are part of a global workforce, which eventually is going to, I mean, they want to put us all into just a digital society. They call us objects in the AI world society.
Wow.
They call us, they say the digital citizens, and we are objects. We are property of the AI world society. Hmm. And then there are AI citizens. They're not even real humans. They're citizens of this AI.
Actual NPCs. You know, I'm sure you've heard the term NPC before.
What?
NPCs, have you heard?
Character. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I feel like none of this would be possible without all of this social conditioning.
Right.
And this priming, and they study human nature really so they know how to program and condition it.
That's 100%.
This is how it looks like to me.
No,
it's forced communitarianism is the big goal. Yes. That's what all Agenda 2030 is about. And they try to make it seem like everything's for the greater good. And, you know, we need to do this because we're saving you all from this or from that. And then at the very base of it, you got the Lucifer Publishing, Lucius Trust, and stuff like that. It's just like you can't make it up.
Well,
it's like the new age is infused with everything.
Exactly.
Everything.
No, I couldn't agree more. And C.N. Stewart had this to say, one of our...
Nice. Yeah, yes. I saw that. That was a good...
We have all been MK-Ultra'd at one level or another.
Yeah.
Poisoned waters, air and food, sort of food, jacked up satellites and towers attack all the electrical engines in our bodies. We have a lot of, and then it cuts off, but...
Yeah, Rumble only lets you put so many words in before it cuts you off.
Unfortunately, as a ranter myself, CN, I'm very disappointed that it didn't cut that off. But
we do need thumbs up, though.
We do need thumbs up, like, you know. But if you want to stop the globalist agenda, you got to hit thumbs up.
Yes.
You know that doesn't happen. So definitely give us a thumbs up. Also, check out Courtney Turner's channel on Rumble. Just go ahead and search for Courtney Turner. You can also look in the comment section of the video. We've been putting some awesome comments in there, some of the books and PDFs that we've been talking about. Go ahead and subscribe to her channel, because if you like this kind of content, she is just pumping it out constantly. So we will, we're 2 hours deep, so we're probably going to start to wind down, although to be honest with you, I could keep talking for like another 5 hours. Let's go ahead and hear from one of our fabulous sponsors.
T-bone.
Good, good.
Chicken.
Good, good.
Bacon.
Good, good.
Salmon.
Good, good.
Ground beef.
Good, good.
Ribeye.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Good Ranchers delivers the best meat and seafood America has to offer. And we ship it straight to your door from real farms and ranches right here in the USA. So whether it's beef, chicken, pork, or seafood, you know it's gonna be
good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good.
Here's what they call it, but yeah.
All right. So don't forget to get yourself some amazing, fabulous steaks from the latest sponsor here. Use the promo code Badland. You can find the links on badlandsmedia.tv. You can find a lot of other great things on there. If you wanted to give us a Rumble rant or support the show, you can also give us a Badlands boost, which cuts out the middleman. And we always appreciate your support. So we're building up to kind of the introduction of mass media, as I know. And this is something that really fascinates me because, you know, as we were just talking about media, we're the intermediary between me and you is this whole media kind of soup that we're living through. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So,
And it's a major conduit for the psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm sure y'all experience it being in the thick of it, but then I see it like just in, and I feel like I'm right in the epicenter of it. And it's some things just seem so, I was never one of those people who was, as a kid, I hated it. I was like, what? I felt so left out. You know, like, why can't I be part of the cliques?
You're right.
But, because I was never in a clique, and I feel that way now, it's actually been kind of my strength.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I see all the patterns. And when you're in it, it's really, again, because of the brainwashing of the group dynamics, it's really hard to see it. And not just the brainwashing, but it's also they have different pressures, right? So if you're part of various groups, you've got financial strings that may be pulled on you. There's a lot of different things, but I think because I'm, you know, just kind of like an independent agent, I really see how much of the alt media, the independent media.
Oh my gosh.
It's not just conservative ink. Like, it's really like
it's everywhere.
Mainstream alternative media, but even the bigger, like, in quote unquote independent, who I don't think are that independent, right. People would be very surprised. And I have some.
Can you give some examples?
I don't want to mention names, but
names,
like,
you know, addresses.
I'll just dox them all. Full disclosure now. I don't really want you just because.
Right. Like, okay, so you mean it's like somebody in our media community that you know?
I think it's just that there are these people who may be perceived as being very independent. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are literally kind of funded ops going on to promulgate various narratives. And a really good example, just because it was brought up earlier, I'll go back to it. You know, I brought up the whole Milner Fabian conspiracy book, and I've had this theory for a while that they're funded off in the alternative media to promulgate anti-Semitism.
Oh, big time. Big time.
And, you know, now, to be fair, there's been an op on the other side to promote Zionism for a very long time. That is not deniable.
They want it to be extremes. You can't, if you criticize Israel, it's the same as, like, you might as well be pulling the lever at Auschwitz. Right. Yes. I mean, it's like
there is no middle ground. There is no nuance. And it really does look like there's this funded op. And I think it kind of began, or maybe didn't begin, but it really started to percolate and, you know, grow. I feel like it was swelling during the Q movement. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of his. Yeah. Prior to that, you really didn't hear people talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Now, I think that those are very misinterpreted. They're weaponized is a better way of explaining it. Weaponized. Yes, absolutely.
Some people think that they were even used to ignite a war. Yeah.
I did a great episode with Peter Duke, who used AI actually to interpret the
I remember you telling me about this.
We had a really great discussion. It's a great book, even though it's a mostly AI written, but he writes kind of a summary for each chapter. So you know, he has his own analysis in there. So before that, though, you really didn't hear and things like the Noahide laws became, you know, everybody's obsessed with how it means all Christians are going to be put into the guillotines. And,
right.
You know, it's this very like fear mongering kind of tactics. And that really started to swell. And then certain players in the alt media started to rise, you know, and there's a lot of money being funneled. And I just started to see in lockstep. It's like people obsessively harping on this narrative. And it's like, you cannot mention Israel with, well, that's genocide. And it's like,
there's the nuance.
And it to me is totally. So that's just an example, you know, without like getting mentioning. But, and this is not to say that, you know, that the whole Zionist movement wasn't. I actually think Zionism was created to hurt Jews. It's not just.
I think it was created to start a war.
The Frankfurt School actually used the Holocaust to, again, this is the whole like in the beginning of identity politics, intersectionality. Mm-hmm. They used the Holocaust to attach Jewish identity to the Holocaust. To create victim mentality.
I think it's
incredibly insulting.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, not every Jew has a family member with a Holocaust survivor. It's not the whole of their entire identity or their belief system.
There's so much thousands of years of like.
Oh, yeah. And it reminds me so much of the same basic underlying mechanics of the movement. I forget the term. 1619 Project is one of the offshoots. But this idea that. If you're black, you're a victim.
Right.
You
know, it's the same thing. Just rebranded. Critical theory is now critical race theory is exactly the same line of thought. It's interesting because this goes back to, and you can find this, people question this a lot. So the evidence for this would be in Antonio Gramsci's grandson's memoirs. But there was a meeting that Lenin had. It was right after the Bolshevik Revolution. He was very confused. He didn't understand why, you know, Karl Marx said that it would just spread throughout the West like wildfire, you know, and it was not happening. And so he called this meeting between Willy Munzenberg, who I would argue is the father of PR, although Bernays, who we've been talking about, gets the credit, not to say that he wasn't very instrumental. But Willy Munzenberg, Georgi Lukacs, and Antonio Gramsci. And he had this meeting, and it was Gramsci who said, "It's the problem is that you're treating this like an economic problem, and you're searching for a way to foment economic revolution, and that will never happen unless you infiltrate the culture."
Yeah.
And it was right after that they set up shop in Frankfurt, Germany, and they started the Institute for Social Research.
Yep, fascinating. So, so we're building up to, I suppose, the introduction of mass media.
Yes.
And one thing I want to contextualize for everybody, because we're so far removed from the world that our ancestors lived in, so to speak. Like, for most of you in history, at least the history we acknowledge, we had very tightly knit communities and social groups. Yeah. You know, now there weren't, it's not like you could talk about anything you wanted. It was still heavily controlled and manipulated. Sure. But it was often organized around a central religious, you know, group, like a church, if we're in a small town. Then there would be, you know, the big players in that small town who owned the butcher shop or the blacksmith shop or things like this. They would have the industries, the local cottage industries, the big cottage industries in the shop. And then people would interlace in some way with them. So you didn't meet your wife, you didn't meet your husband unless you were part of this social group. So each highly networked social group, your culture dictated everything, what you could or could not say at the dinner table, how you greeted your potential future mate, who you asked for the hand in marriage, all these kind of things. And that most of the socializing or the things that we get out of media today happened through that social network.
Yeah. Okay?
If you wanted to know, get a horse and buggy, you had to know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. You needed to be able to talk to them. Now we don't live in that world. Now we live in a world where everything comes through media, right? Well, all of this really began to take shape at around the times we're talking about in the 1910s, 1920s, and by, I would argue, around the 1930s, it was in full assault of that. You have mass media really coming onto the scene. So, with that tech context, where do you think would be a good place to begin talking about how, you know, not necessarily mass media, but whatever the next step in the story is? Right. I just wanted to...
Well, I would just say that, you know, this idea of using a culture for social engineering is in no way new. They've been doing this, you know, the ancient Greeks created the Olympics, and that was a way of, you know, culture creation. So the term
Colosseum,
circuses, right? That comes from an ancient Roman poet. There was a staff. The term an eye from an eye came from a propaganda piece of art that was a staff.
Wow.
Listing, like, you know, something like 240 idioms.
Right.
This is something that has been used from the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. And art is just a very powerful way to create propaganda for culture creation, mm-hmm. because it's visceral. You know, when things are logical and rational, you can create a much more conscious defense against it. You can argue and rationalize your way against something or out of something, or create separation. But when something affects you on a guttural, visceral level, then you're immediately impacted. You're cellularly changed. We know that music has the power to effectuate cellular change. Mm-hmm. But we don't know this part why they change the hertz, right? From 32 to 440. One is healing and one can be very jarring and disruptive for humans. So this has been ongoing. But what has changed is, just like the example I used of Tavistock, would bring these 25 literary figures together. You know, they were doing that from the beginning of time. But what's changed is the technology. You had the printing press, but at first they started with theater and sports.
Yeah, Shakespeare was used
culture.
To do exactly that. Like, it was used to bring out these ideas in a way you couldn't do it in the public square because you'd get beheaded. So Shakespeare, a guy who couldn't even write,
right,
you know, was suddenly penning these masterpieces that were highly critical of the crown and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were doing this, you know, from very, very early on. The technology changed. So you have the printing press, and now you've got, you know, literature. And so they start to, you know, infiltrate and create culture through literature. And then we get to the radio. And I think that was really the next step of media culture creation. And so in the timeline of Tavistock, we have around 1934, this is John Rowling Rees pulls off a PR coup, which obtained patronage from the Duke of Kent. And this was huge, because this is what it really brought it onto the medical scene, the social scene. It was enabled them to expand. Right. So that was huge. That was in the 1930s. There was also the Tavistock Medical Psychology Clinic. Right. That was, I believe, 1931.
So back up 1 second. So you said there was a PR coup. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So he had, like, basically done, like, all this kind of publicity in order to garner attention, essentially. Okay. And it gained the attention of the Duke of Kent, who donated a lot of money.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. All right.
So it's basically like a publicity
stunt. He like bought PR as we know it, basically.
What?
He bought PR as we know it, basically.
Yeah. And so the Duke of Kent ended up granting, you know, a huge sum of money.
All right.
And then the 1930s, and that this, you know, it expanded greatly at that point, because it started out with 7 doctors, 249 patients. And then by 1939, there were 90 doctors, 1,811 patients, with the adult department seeing 26,500 appointments in just the first half of the year.
What year was it again?
That was by 1939.
So well into Rockefeller medicine.
Yeah. Rockefeller medicine, I mean, that was 1910.
As it built out over the years.
Yeah. And there were direct ties with Rockefeller and Gates and Tavistock as well.
Yep.
Yes.
The whole eugenics.
Rockefeller was funded most of Tavistock. I mean, he was one of the big
grant.
So I don't know if you want to continue from here. I would say in 1935 was when they did the psychology of radio experiment.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we talk about that? Because I think that'll be a good like cliffhanger. Yeah.
So and that was Cantrill, and that was 1935, and he had done the invasion. So the invasion from Mars was in 1940, and Cantrill was actually roommates with Nelson Rockefeller.
Really?
Yeah, at Dartmouth.
Wow. they cook up the idea way back then, I guess.
So he becomes the head of a radio psychology department. I think it was for NBC. I don't remember exactly. But I'll see if I can find it. Mm-hmm. I definitely have the notes on that. But that was and that was essentially to study the impacts of radio and mass panic.
Right.
Really.
I mean, because we'll go ahead and try to find out. So prior to this, like we had our early kind of primordial form of mass media in the form, like you were saying, the printing press. That was huge. We could print out massive amounts of information. But the only problem with the printing press, and this has always been a problem for the globalists, is that you have to read it. And if you don't know how to read, that's a problem. And, you're kind of getting one mind at a time through slow encroaching. But with radio, it socializes this propaganda medium for the first time. Unless you're in a play, which is a huge area to have it happen too, like to Ryan's point, that you couldn't really socialize reading a pamphlet. You couldn't socialize necessarily reading a 300-page book about, by Jane Austen or something like that. But with radio, it's a whole thing now. You gather around the radio box. It becomes an aspect of the family's daily, activities. And so, it's a huge...
It's a shared experience, essentially. Right. And it becomes like right in your living room. And that's what happened with TV. Now you not only have the audio, but you have the visual.
Right.
And it's right in your living room. This is why people... I mean, now it's on your phone. Mm-hmm. But this is why people feel like they know celebrities.
Yep, right? Exactly.
So it was 1935 when the Harvard psychologist Gordon Alford co-authored The Psychology of Radio with Hadley Cantrill. And Alford would lead the charge of the U.S. for Tavistock Institute. And Cantrill in 1937 was a member of Rockefeller Foundation-funded Office of Radio Research at Princeton.
Okay.
I do think there was an NBC division, though. Mm-hmm. And don't quote me on that. I'd have to look it up, but I'm pretty sure I remember that. To study the influence of radio on different groups of listeners. And yes, Cantrill was Nelson Rockefeller's roommate at Dartmouth. In 1940, Cantrill co-authored The Invasion from Mars, a study in the psychology of panic regarding the radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the
Worlds. Yeah, that was so much data was harvested from that.
What was World?
Interesting, though, is that Rockefeller wouldn't let him publish it for a few years.
Really?
So I have no idea what happened or, why.
Hmm. What was the year for that one?
The War of the Worlds?
The broadcast.
1940, okay. So right around the same time this was happening.
You know the lore from the Black Projects, the whole ufology stuff? What had happened at that point?
Oh, gosh.
Do you remember?
I know the Trinity experiments were a big thing, but that's 7 years later. That's 1947.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember from... Well, you had the Order of the Black Sun. This is ufology lore, blending these two together. You got the Order of the Black Sun using spiritualism and mediumship as a way to try to make contact with Discarnate Billings. You have the Vril Society and those guys thinking that they are making contact with discarnate beings. And so, the theory is that they did actually make contact with some discarnate beings or aliens, whatever term you want to give them. So whether physical beings or these extra dimensional beings. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, they decided to kind of use that idea in popular media, and we see all this explosion of technology. Some people think it was Tesla and the things Tesla was doing, and then the experiments they were doing with Tesla's technology that was like a pre-Trinity, meaning that, you know, where the idea is that there's all these hyper-advanced civilizations kind of like acting like nanny to the Earth. And then, you know, there all of a sudden there's these big, you know, potentially world-ending technologies being developed. And so they try to reach a hand down and be like, hey, guys, you should really stop playing with fire, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's the theory anyway. I'm not necessarily saying that's true or have any evidence to back that up, but that was some of the lore.
I was wondering because, like, it seems like that's something, like, whether it's real or not, that the Rockefellers of the world were very interested in at the time. And, you know, Adolf Hitler, et cetera. It was like a thing. So if, you know, H.G. Wells is in the upper echelons of this, like, knowingly or unknowingly in this cabal system, you know, maybe there was a reason they wanted to get the messaging right and stuff like that.
So back to the Rockefeller Foundation, in 1933, the Rockefeller Foundation, Max Mason, assured the Rockefeller financiers in their program that the social sciences would concern themselves with rationalization of social control, the control of human behavior.
Wow. No kidding.
A direct quote.
Wow.
I mean, so, you know, wrapping some of these things together, you've got the Tavistock people talking about the effects of trauma and its ability to kind of soften people's minds. And then you have, you know, hyper advanced technologies. Again, keep in mind that around when these things were happening, you had massive changes in human behavior. What did we do for most of human history? We either walked or rode horses everywhere.
Right.
All of a sudden we have these cars, these trains that are coming in. So there's this whole air of the world is changing in a way that, you know, we're going to
industrialization.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And what are we experiencing now? The fourth industrial revolution.
Bingo.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you have the War of the Worlds happening. You have this book. What is the paper that I forget you were just mentioning about?
The Psychology of Radio.
Yeah. The Psychology of Radio. So it's, you know, if I'm a globalist back then and I'm trying to see, like, what would be the big linchpin for getting this finally cracking the human mind and pouring in the trauma that we've been learning about for the past 40 years, 50 mm-hmm. years, and also doing it en masse so it's a socialized ritual so that we can program people. Now we have this thing called mass, you know, radio that's really just going to completely take off and take over. So. Wow, fascinating. Do you know when the BBC became an organization? Was it back then?
I think the BBC was later.
I couldn't remember if there was some organization that's remained. Let's see. Maybe it was ABC. October 18th, 1922. Yeah, okay. So it was the BBC I was thinking of.
Yeah.
So
right around the same time that Tavistock was starting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
So they seem to have been experimenting with this. So, you know, to what extent this control of radio and media was being used completely, I'm not entirely sure, but unquestionably, you know, by the time the 1950s started up, the world had already been radically altered by these mass media.
Yeah, and then Emory was involved in a whole study for Tavistock on the psychology of television.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, film, I don't need to let her. Yeah.
Hollywood and all.
CIA literally has like a film liaison department.
It's Hollywood? Like, yeah.
It's right on their website. Like, it's pretty out there in the open.
There you go.
Yeah, this is not a question. They even like proudly talk about some of their film and television programs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah. The concept of soft disclosure. Like, things that are hidden. Oh, we can tell people about it through movies. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Disclosure through fiction. Yeah. So any other last nuggets on this aspect of the story before we start to wind down?
Before we start to wind down. I think that's pretty. We can go. I guess we could go on for quite a while.
Right.
So we can get further next time.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I think that's a place to
stop it. Okay, so if you liked this first part of the series, you're going to love what we have coming next, everybody. So this is just the beginning of a very involved and hopefully revealing conversation for you. Courtney's research is fascinating. Don't forget to check out the description for some of the links that we happen to put in there. If they are not in there now, you can check the comments and you can check all of Courtney's socials and platforms, CourtneyTurner.com. You can find a lot of her amazing content on Rumble. I think it's Courtney Turner is the same brand name there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Courtney Turner.
Courtney Turner. Yeah. Do you have any other places you send people or other things you're doing that you want to mention before we close out the show?
Well, I have two things that I'm, so I do the rebelsforcause.com, so the cause fest, and
yes,
it's cause fest, creative artists uniting for the sovereignty of everyone. And it is to counteract things like Tavistock, so that we have some organic culture creation. And it's really just because I feel like I don't even want to put the label because labels are part of what they do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people who are pro-freedom, pro-sovereign, personal sovereignty, we tend to be on the defense. And so I really wanted to be like, well, what are we for? Mm. And so I wanted to offer up some sort of culture that could be, you know, fun without being degenerative.
Right.
So that was really my mission in that. And we are fundraising. We want to do another one. So you can check out the website and see we have 26 and a half hours of content from the last one on there.
Wow.
We're in the process of putting it up, but I did two aerial acrobatic performances. We had several speakers. We had
music
comedians, and we had musicians, lots of music, panel discussions, filmmakers.
A hypnotist.
Yeah.
So I was actually, one of my first jobs out of college was I was a hypnotherapist.
Nice.
But I quit after about 9 months because I couldn't be hypnotized.
No way.
I've learned that there are divergent personalities or a small portion. So people may be familiar with the whole like mass formation psychosis.
Oh, yeah.
To a third, a third, a third. You know, one third of the population are less susceptible to hypnotic suggestion, and I must be in that. I did help people, but I felt like a fraud, so I quit. But anyway, that would be one thing. And then I don't have it up yet, but I have been asked to be part of the Geneva Project. Mm. And this is part of the Inspired Global Leadership Summit, which will be at the end of May, and it is the same time as the WHO is working on their pandemic accords and their amendments for the pandemic treaty.
International health regulations and everything.
Yeah.
To enslave and control us all. Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like from my perspective. And so I've been asked to be a part of essentially a group kind of think tank project to counteract them. But it is in Geneva, Switzerland. And I'm honored to be, even asked to go. And I would love to, you know, at least make an attempt to be a part of combating their, what I perceive as evil agenda. But it is a very expensive thing to do.
Especially
so I'm going to be putting together a Give and Go specifically for that. But in the meantime, if you want to just, you know, help fund Mike, if I can't raise enough money, I will not go. Because I just can't do that. But if you want to support my endeavor, then you can go to my website there. You can buy products or you can just do Gibbs and Go or Venmo or buy me coffee, lots of coffee, whatever way you want to contribute. So you can even do snail mail through the P.O. box.
Are you familiar with James Roguski?
I am, but I'm not super familiar.
He is like the authority on tracking the pandemic treaty. It's just the colloquial name. It's called the WHOCA plus blah, blah, blah. You could have him on your show.
We
have his contact information. Okay. He would love to come out, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Throw with him. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for watching. Don't forget to check out all of Courtney's channels. We'll be back in some time for part two of the Tavistock unveiling. Lots of amazing information here. Don't forget, I know this stuff sounds dark and it kind of sounds like there's no hope, but think about it this way. They spend trillions of dollars and have been planning, scheming, and conniving just to keep you from discovering who you really are, using your own critical thinking, and working with other people of like mind to stop you from doing the right thing. Because it's only when the good people do nothing that evil flourishes. So you're way more powerful than you think.
Powerful enough to hit that thumbs up button.
That's right. Yes. I took the words right out of my mouth. So yeah, definitely hit the thumbs up. Check out all of Courtney's channels. And with that, everybody, much love, take care, and we'll see you next time on Vigilant News.
Thank you so much for joining us, and don't forget to hit the thumbs up on this video. And a special thank you to all of our advertising partners. Please remember to shift your dollars to support those businesses that support Badlands Media.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.